to start streaming, and as soon as he gives us a thumbs up, we can go.
All right, great. All right, Amanda, I get a message that meeting is now streaming live, so we're good to go, I think.
Yep, and I just got a message from Julius, so you're all set. Okay.
So members, welcome to day two of our hearings. I'll call the meeting of the Lessard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council to order. This is a continuation of our meeting yesterday, hearing our proposals. Thank you all for being here early in the morning again. Before we get going, I just wanted to mention that you've all been sent an allocation spreadsheet, and if you look closely at it, on the right of the numbers portion of it, where you put in your allocation and notes, you notice there's a series of other numbers, which is an automatically populating field that will break down two things. One is where the allocation goes: metro, urban, forest, prairie, southeast, forest, prairie, and the total, as well as to the right of that, whether it is enhance, restore, or protect, so that you can sort of see then totals of your allocation, which may inform how you want to adjust numbers at the end. Joe did this work. I think it'll be very helpful. Last night he added at the bottom a percentage, so you can see of your allocation what percent it is of the total. For example, in the metro urban, if you go down to the total beyond the dollars, you'll see there's a percent that automatically populates. This is just a tool to help you think through your allocation as you're doing it. If you're like me, you put in numbers and then you wonder if you got the right numbers, and you play with them a bit to get to your final allocation. And this would just be a tool to help you think through that. So Joe, thank you for doing that work. I think people will find that helpful. Before we get going, are there any thoughts that anyone had last night in thinking through what we went through yesterday, suggestions for improvement, or just general thoughts before we get going? Gee, I'm not hearing any. All right. We must be doing all right.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mark.
Yeah, this is Mark. Just for, I don't know, I would imagine everybody's aware just because of looking at the timestamps on their emails, but Amanda was up late getting some stuff out to you all last night. And I just wanted to, for the record, say thank you to Amanda. She really, we really appreciate your work. So thank you, Amanda.
Indeed. To really to all the staff to help put this together. This is no easy task to put this meeting together. And I know we ran ahead yesterday. Amanda has arranged so that some of our presenters from tomorrow are available today in the event we run ahead again today, so that we can shorten our whole process. And it's even possible we could get through this tomorrow if we run ahead enough. But Amanda organized all of that with all of the presenters. So no small amount of work. So thank you to Amanda and the rest of the staff for putting this all together. With that, I think we'll just get going. Our first presentation is PREO2, Enhanced Public Land Grasslands. Alexander Nelson presenting. Alex, unmute yourself and go ahead.
Perfect. Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. Mr. Chair and Council members, I'm Alex Nelson with Presence Forever. I'm the Minnesota Restoration Manager. With me is Scott Gloop with the Fish and Wildlife. So a recent conducted survey by Presence Forever members and our non-members that visit our social media platform concluded essentially that public land enhancement is their number one priority. And this proposal directly addresses that priority. So I'm here, you know, representing our 73 chapters, over 20,000 PF members in Minnesota. And we're looking to accomplish, I guess, essentially their number one priority along with our agency partners' priorities and, you know, the science that backs up the restoring wetlands, removing invasive trees, conducting diversity seedings, prescribed fire, conservation grazing on 10,000 acres of public land that's open to hunting. So with this proposal, as in the last four phases now, instead of pre-selecting projects, Presence Forever sends out a request for proposal to agency partners, chapter members, kind of local clubs, you know, the people that are out there using these public lands. Once we receive these proposals back and get approval from our agency partners, we start working with private contractors to, you know, well, agency partners design the specifics of the scope of work, but then hiring the skilled private contractors that we have out there within the state of Minnesota. So it's a little different model probably than the other people are used to, but it's been very successful in addressing high priority projects and really reaching out to the, you know, our members and chapters that use these public lands. I would like to touch briefly on some of the past phases of enhanced public lands. So if you can just reference the handout, if you notice that, you know, phase one is closed out, phase two, we've, you know, pretty much spent all of our contract funds and we're just wrapping up the final report at this time. Phase three, pretty much all the contract money is contracted and we're waiting on just those private contractors out there to complete the work. In phase four, which just, you know, became, you know, active as July 1, we sent out one request for proposal and we were able to obligate all the contract funds. So currently we're sitting with, in past phases, all the money obligated, and that's why we're here looking to kind of keep moving the needle and into phase five. So at this time, I'd like to turn it over to Scott Gloop with the Fish and Wildlife Service to, you know, add his comments. And at that point, we'll be happy to stand for any questions you may have.
You need to unmute yourself, Scott.
How about that? Can you hear me?
There you go. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, council members, good morning. As much as I dislike the early morning drive down to the Capitol to do this, I sure wish I was sitting in front of you personally. I'd like to touch on two things really quickly. Alex already mentioned the local aspect, but I thought I'd expand on that a little bit. Many of the local PF chapters I work with, you know, announce at their banquets when they're, you know, trying to raise funds that a certain portion of what they raise is going to be allocated to this program to work on lambs locally. And that really goes over really, really well. So oftentimes when Alex contacts us about these funds, I usually already know that the local chapters are planning on throwing some money in. And I go to them and I say, okay, you guys are the ones that are out there using this land. You tell me what you want. You know, we've all, especially if we're pheasant hunters, we've walked across those brome grass areas that we can't wait to get to the other side because we know there's not going to be much in there. And those are the types of things I ask those people to supply to me is, okay, you pick the WPAs that you think need work and we'll work on those. So I try to get that local input. Also, it's not uncommon that a neighbor might call us during the course of the year or whatever and say, hey, you know, the land's next to me, the cedar trees are taking over the grass, or, you know, this wetland, the dike must have blown out and it's not holding water again. So we kind of take note of that, and this provides us opportunities to go out there and work on those projects. Another thing that was a real bright spot for me this year, as you know, with COVID, we were pretty much shut down this spring. It was very, very difficult for us to get out into the field and get a lot of our work done due to CDC guidelines, but we were still able to work with these private landowners and keep a lot of our work going, our habitat improvement projects going out on the land. And I can tell you, I spent a lot of time sitting in my, I'll call this my office, my bedroom, lamenting about us not being able to get out in the field, but it made me feel a lot better knowing that we still had some of these private contractors out there getting some work done. So that was a particularly bright spot this year. And at that, I'll turn it over and take any questions you may have.
All right, members, any questions? Mark, is that a question?
Yep. Morning, guys. I'm just trying to, as I'm reading this, this looks like this is PF's and the Fed's version of grassland management coupled on to the state's DNR's grassland management that we heard yesterday. I'm just clarifying that because it, I mean, you've got DNR listed as a partner, but I don't see, I'm just wondering, is any of this work going to be done on DNR land? And then two, do you have any relationship with the roving crews? Would you be contracting with the DNR roving crews to do any of this work?
Mr. Chair and members, we will be working on WMAs, you know, along with refuges and WPAs, as long as they're open to public hunting. We will not be contracting with the roving crews. You know, we look at this as an addition to the amount of work that we have out there. And, you know, we've made a lot of progress, but there's still a lot to get done. And, you know, this year was a pretty good construction season, but last year we were way behind with how much rain we had, and we didn't have frost, so we couldn't do different stuff. So more hands on deck, the better, I guess. Thank you.
Benny, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Nelson or Mr. Gloop, thanks for all you do. And I do really like the program. Just wanted to confirm a follow-up to Commissioner Holston. You probably don't go into spots on a WMA that a roving crew is best suited with their equipment to do. You would concentrate more where the contractors in spots, you coordinate with them, I guess. I just want to confirm that you said that, but you must strategically pick some of those spots and the type of work that a contractor is best to do.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, that is correct. So I'll receive this, you know, I think I had over 100 proposals come in for phase four. In the meantime, though, before those proposals go in, we've vetted them with the local managers. And they have a better understanding of where the roving crews are working and where they can be best utilized. And so I'm working with, you know, every manager across the state to kind of help efficiently put contractors in the right spot and let the roving crews do what they do best. Thank you.
Dan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gloop, I'm curious, and I recognize the value of grasslands for pheasants and so forth, but you also mentioned cedar trees and the removal of those. My experience pheasant hunting, especially late season when you get to, you know, the first week in January when there's a lot of adverse weather and a lot of snow on the ground, we find lots and lots of pheasants in, I'll say, the shelter belts and especially the conifers. Tell me what you do to enhance that. It just sounded like you're just going to get rid of all the cedar trees. What do you have for winter habitat? That's kind of what I'm getting at.
Well, the cattails, the large cattail sloughs that are quite common in my area, at least, are phenomenal winter habitat. There's been a lot of research that shows that is really, really critical on the tough winters, more so than trees are. So we focus, you know, well, we don't manage specifically to create cattails. In fact, in a lot of our areas, we're starting to get too many with the new invasive hybrid cattail. But as far as pheasants go, that is wonderful habitat. The thing about trees is when you have a few, they're not a problem, but they don't stay a few. And they creep up on you. And all of a sudden, next thing you know, you have these large blocks, especially in our area, where it's just solid cedar trees. And it's virtually desolate habitat for almost anything. I mean, you have cedar trees with bare ground underneath and very, very little diversity. So it's kind of a catch 22 on the tree thing. If you don't get on it soon enough, it gets ahead of you and then you have massive loss of habitat. So I don't know if that answers your question, but.
Other questions? I am struck with sort of the overlap between the roving crews and this and confused as to why we need both. I guess I understand on the federal land because the roving crews are pretty much looking at state lands, but what's the need for this on state lands when we have the roving crews?
Mr. Chair, members, I can't speak for DNR's proposal, but I know Pheasants Forever has our network of volunteers, dedicated members, that not only help with some logistics on this type of work, but also bring these projects, you know, to the forefront that we can address. Pheasants Forever has always been we're proud of trying to spend this money as efficiently as we possibly can, whether that's donating some of our direct support services in kind or actively trying to leverage the OHF dollars with non-state and federal money. And, you know, frankly, there's a lot to do. And some of our construction seasons haven't been the best. And if we can get, you know, DNR contracting, roving crews moving, and then obviously PF and, you know, working with our private contractors, I don't think there'd be any shortage of work. You know, we need, like I said earlier, more hands on deck.
Other questions? Dan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I agree with Mr. Nelson. There's a tremendous amount of work to do. The roving crews, I think they're stretched fairly thin. I like the idea of the enhancement, and I've said that many times. Former Chair McNamara heard me talk about that a lot in committee. there's where I live in Northwest Minnesota, there are literally thousands, tens, many tens of thousands of acres of WMA. And I've talked for 10 years about, you know, taking care of what we have and enhancing what we have. Alex and Mr. Gloop, I like your proposal, and I think that there's plenty of work to do. So thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your tolerance here.
Denny, and then Ron, and then we're going to move on.
Just real quick, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to say, out on the landscape, there are still so many both WMA and WPAs in brome grass, and we know those were mistakes from decades ago. And just correcting those and getting native prairie in them or establishing prairie in them has really worked fantastic and really increased the not only the birds that we like to hunt, but all the non-game and the butterflies and bees. It's phenomenal to see. So, yes, I'm glad to see we're really going after this enhancement. Thank you.
All right, Ron?
Well, I wanted to get my 2 cents worth on the tree discussion here, because I think a little confusion possibly. Trees are bad if there are scattered cedars around and no just wild ones. We all get that. But I got to tell you that cedar-based shelter belts built expressly for wildlife winter cover often is better than cattails, because cattails can fill up with snow. And the trees are better. I mean, this has been proven a long time ago. So I think if we're talking about tree shelter belts, I would encourage those with cedar, but it sounded like they weren't considering shelter belts. So I just wanted to give my 2 cents there. Thank you.
If you want to respond, that's fine. Otherwise, we're going to move on. No response.
Well, the only thing I would mention is, you know, what we see in our area is you will have whole WPAs, if they're not managed with fire, that just turn into solid stands of cedars. And I've had many landowners. There's one gentleman I know well that's 94 years old here, and he's told me many times, when the first cedars showed up in this area, we thought it was really cool. And now I hate them. You know, because it's just like anything, it has to be managed. A little bit's okay, too much is not. So that's the decisions we try to work through and when we manage our land, so.
All right, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
We will move on to PRE 03, Anoka Sand Plain Habitat Conservation, Wiley Buck with Great River Greening. Go ahead, Wiley, when you're ready, unmute yourself. There you are.
Thanks. Good morning, Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity for Anoka Sand Plain 7 to present. As Chairman said, my name is Wiley Buck, Senior Program Manager with Great River Greening. GRG is the partnership lead, the grant manager, and we are the direct manager for 7 of the identified RNE parcels. I've got several other people here with me today that I'd like you to meet. Carrie?
Yeah, hi, my name is Carrie Taylor. I'm a restoration ecologist with the Anoka Conservation District, and I'll be facilitating the rare plant rescue program and also the restoration and enhancements in Anoka County.
Hi, I'm Leah Hall with the Nature Conservancy. I'm a freshwater project manager for them and will be leading the wetland restoration and enhancement work for this proposal.
Good morning. My name is Matt Wigman. I'm a district biologist with the National Wild Turkey Federation for Minnesota, and I will be facilitating work with the Little Falls Area Wildlife Office.
Hi, my name is Christina Geiger. I'm a program manager with the Minnesota Land Trust. I am responsible for acquisition of conservation easements in the Anoka Sand Plain.
Good morning. My name is Chuck Perrins. I'm from Morrison County, and I'm the environmental recreational manager here. And I'm one of the local landowners working on the environmental improvement project for our county, Belle Prairie Park, and it's a part of the Anoka Sand Plain ecoregion. Thank you.
All right, so as you can see, we've got five direct recipient organizations. Each one of us has identified the Anoka Sand Plain as a priority landscape, and we all have our organizational resources and talents and contacts that we're bringing to this proposal and to this partnership, offering a multifaceted package to state and local landowners to address the needs and the opportunities in the large and diverse Anoka Sand Plain ecoregion. We do have an opportunity in the Anoka Sand Plain. It's a tremendous resource. It has quite a mosaic of habitat, including high quality prairie, the best remaining oak savanna in the state, woodland, and wetlands, some of which have a very high concentration of rare plants. Anoka Sand Plain also has four large terrestrial habitat cores and sections of three wild and scenic rivers. 150,000 acres are ranked as outstanding or high by the County Biological Survey, and the DNR reports that it provides habitat to 97 wildlife species of greatest conservation need. And then if that's not enough, beyond habitat, the region offers a lot of close to home hunting, volunteering, and other recreation, given its proximity to the population centers. And with its sandy soils and large rivers, it's a key area for water quality, quantity, and recharge. And given its proximity to the population centers, there is some urgencies. Some of the most rapid population growth in the state and development is identified in Anoka and Sherburne counties, right in the heart of the Anoka Sand Plain. And that requires us to move swiftly and strategically to conserve habitat alongside these economic drivers. And to that strategic end, our 10-year strategic plan is about a year and a half, 2 years old now. And this is what guides our opportunities and a lot of our decision-making, summary of which you have in your hearing handout. This is the executive summary of that. So for delivery, we are seeking $5.8 million in your support to add on to our track record. For that $5.8 million, we anticipate 1,250 acres of restoration and enhancement, the rescue of 100,000 rare plants, taking them from development sites into protected sites, and protection of another 540 high-quality acres. This money will allow us to continue and even accelerate and build upon the 11,000 acres of restoration and enhancement, the more than 2 miles of shoreline, and the over 350 acres of protection that we've completed to date. So we feel we have a proven track record, a vibrant partnership, and momentum on our side to effectively address the conservation challenges of this ecologically important and increasingly threatened landscape. So we thank you for your past support and current consideration. And on that note, we are ready to take questions.
All right, questions from the members? Any questions? Apparently you've done an adequate job. Thank you very much. We appreciate you being with us this morning.
Again, it's our pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
So next we will do WRE02, Living Shallow Lake Enhancement and Wetland Restoration Initiative. John Schneider. John, unmute yourself and you're ready to go.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and council members. I'm John Schneider from Ducks Unlimited, and I direct our conservation programs in Minnesota from my home office here in Alexandria. With me today is DU biologist Doug McLean and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service biologist Stacy Salvable, both from Fergus Falls, Minnesota. Not here with us is our team of seven other DU staff engineers and additional biologists that help perform survey, design, and construction management tasks for our wetland enhancement and restoration work. This proposal is phase seven of our ongoing shallow lake enhancement and wetland restoration program that features our wetland engineering expertise needed to improve and restore wetlands, including large public water basins and also drained and degraded smaller prairie pothole wetlands on public land and easements as well. The justification for this work is that 90% of prairie Minnesota's wetlands have been drained and lost. And those prairie basins that remain are mostly degraded and too turbid to support aquatic plants and invertebrates that both breeding ducks and migrating ducks require for food resources. This is due to excessive nutrients and invasive fish such as common carp and some are partially drained and filled with invasive plants such as hybrid cattail, reed canary grass, and trees that prevent ducks from accessing those basins. This limits Minnesota's breeding duck population and also the length of time migrating ducks spend in Minnesota during both spring and fall migration periods due to the lack of abundant aquatic food resources. So in short, our Living Lakes Initiative strives to both enhance the larger wetlands and shallow lake basins that were too deep to drain years ago and still remain on the landscape, while also restoring and enhancing smaller drained wetlands and enhancing degraded potholes on public land too. Our goal is to make these basins as ecologically productive as possible for waterfowl and other wetland-dependent wildlife. Through this proposal, DU will enhance 2,000 acres of public water shallow lakes by engineering and installing water level control structures used by agencies for drawdowns to rid lakes and wetlands of carp and to rejuvenate their aquatic ecology. Additionally, we will restore and or enhance an additional 200 acres of drained prairie pothole wetlands on public federally owned waterfowl production areas or state wildlife management areas or permanently protected conservation easements that were either missed years ago or had become degraded. As listed in the DU handout we provided, about 80% or over 5 million of our request is budget is for contracts with private construction contractors to build water level control structures with fish barriers we design or to move dirt and remove sediment and trees to restore or enhance small wetlands. The remaining 20% of our budget is for DU engineering and staff biologist time to design and manage the field work and the equipment needed to do so. Also, as noted in the handout that we provided, we've completed phases 1 through 4, and we've 91% spent out and nearly completed phase 5, and we're about halfway through phase 6, and we fully anticipate being out of funding by the end of 2021. So this request is really to keep this program moving forward in the future and keeping staff planning ahead for the next few projects and gainfully employed, frankly. The newer aspect of this phase 7 program proposal this year is that we are expanding our work with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to restore drained and enhanced degraded small prairie pothole wetlands on older federal waterfowl production areas and conservation easements that were missed years ago or had just simply become degraded over time. Here to tell you about that work is Stacy Salvable from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Fergus Falls Wetland Management District.
Well, good morning, Chair Hartwell and council members. I'm Stacy Salvable. I'm a wildlife biologist with the Fish and Wildlife Service. I'm just here to share with you, Fish and Wildlife Service recently initiated a renewed effort to restore and enhance wetlands on waterfowl production areas throughout Minnesota. Wetland restoration methods were in their infancy 30 to 60 years ago when we were purchasing many of our waterfowl production areas throughout the state. Historically, a wetland was thought to be restored by removing the ditch. A ditch would be plugged with earth, or a tile would be broken or removed for a short distance. Many of those restorations never completely restored wetlands, as we've found tile remaining in many degraded wetlands. Some small wetlands were missed altogether, and some complex restorations were never completed. So now we restore wetlands focusing on functional hydrology and longevity of the restoration in the landscape, using techniques like complete backfilling of ditches, complete removal of tile, removal of sediment that eroded into the wetlands, and the removal of invasive plants. Restoration and enhancement of wetlands using new techniques improves both the amount and quantity of habitat for waterfowl and other wetland-dependent species. We can significantly increase the quality of some of these basins with our newer techniques and expect them to last long into the future. Thank you very much for your time and the consideration of our proposal. John and I welcome questions that you have for the two of us.
Great. Members, questions? Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, guys, for bringing this one in. Yesterday we had an opportunity to hear the DNR Shallow Lakes program. And I get this is additive. It's going to be on WMAs and on WPAs. But I guess the question is more maybe to Stacy, or, well, to you too, John. I guess, is there a difference in the work that's going to be done? I mean, I guess, is there a different philosophy or approach to the type of work that the DNR is going to do on their specific wetland enhancements?
Mr. Chair, Member Holston, thank you for that question. I can't really speak for DNR's proposal fully, but I will tell you what I know about it and how it differs from Ducks Unlimited. It's basically, our efforts are to augment what the state is doing. It's to supplement the shallow lake needs on the landscape and more horsepower. But in addition to that, there's certainly things that the state does and can do that Ducks Unlimited can't. And so that makes the state's Shallow Lakes program proposal unique in that regard. Things like spraying cattails with the DNR helicopter is a great example. We don't have the authority, nor frankly, the desire to get involved in spraying public water wetlands for hybrid cattail. The Shallow Lakes program that the DNR has includes many Shallow Lake staff that are doing assessments and monitoring and evaluation. And we actually partner with them on our projects too. And so it's a hand in glove partnership, but as an NGO, we tried one time many years ago to do it together in one proposal. It became unwieldy, frankly, and we needed some autonomy to do our thing and DNR to do their thing. And we're pulling on the same rope just through two different proposals. So there are some differences, but it's very parallel, similar track work.
Great. Other questions?
Well, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mark.
Yeah, I to John's point, I think that was what I was really kind of hoping to hear. I think it's kind of same with PF and their grassland management that we just heard earlier. That coordination that exists between the agencies and the NGOs out doing the work, how important that you've got the professional staff inside the bureaucracies doing their work, and how the NGOs are able to come in and utilize that work and bring additional resources to the table to get this enhancements and restorations done. So I guess that was really one of the points I was hoping to make.
Great, thanks. Other questions, comments? Seeing none, thank you both, or all three of you. We appreciate you showing up this morning.
Thank you.
Keep up the good work.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much for your time.
Next, we will move on to WA01, Accelerating the Waterfowl Production Area Program. With Aaron Sandquist. Aaron, you're there, but you're muted. Great.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and council members.
Morning.
My name is Aaron Sandquist, Pheasants Forever State Coordinator here from Minnesota. I'm here today representing our PF members and chapters in Minnesota that highly value the acceleration of permanent protection of wildlife habitat across the Pheasant Range of Southern Minnesota. And with me today is Scott Gloop, Fish and Wildlife Service Project Leader out of Litchfield. I'm going to be as brief as possible and to the point today, as this partnership program has been in existence since the start of the Legacy Amendment. And our goal is pretty simple. We are working to accelerate the fee title protection of waterfowl production areas in an area of the state where little public land exists, often less than 3% of the land base. This year, we've sharpened our pencil a little, and together with the Fish and Wildlife Service and our 73 chapters of Pheasants Forever across the state, we are happy to be bringing over $7 million in non-state match to this proposal. The projects you see in this proposal were developed in partnership with the Fish and Wildlife Service using the best science and biological need. And just a quick mention here before I turn it over to Scott about our previous funding progress. Phases 1 through 5, we have final reports that are completed and approved. We're drafting the final report for phase 6, and that'll soon be sent in. Phases 7 through 9, our acquisition portion is completed with the balance that's left there you see primarily for restorations. Phases 10 and 11, we're completing the last of our acquisition portion of those phases and have a good start on those restoration as well. And then last but not least, phase 12, the appropriation we just received this past July, we've got 5 appraisals contracted on that one. So, you know, we're real proud that this partnership has stood the test of time. And as you can see from the table in that handout, we are not only completing our work timely, but also routinely exceeding our leverage and match acre goals. We are among the most cost-efficient and effective at delivering outdoor heritage funds to the places and projects that need it most. On behalf of this partnership and the wildlife that benefit, thank you for allowing us to help deliver the council's vision. Now I'd like to turn it over to Scott Gloop to give some Fish and Wildlife Service perspective.
Mr. Chair, council members, I guess I didn't need felt I didn't introduce myself last time, but I manage the Litchfield Wetland Management District, a 7-county area just west of the metro. I'm sure you're all aware that people have been particularly engaged in outdoor activities during this COVID crisis. In Minnesota, fishing and turkey license sales were up this year. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has documented a significant increase in public use on our national wildlife refuges. I have been coordinating and leading a high adventure trip through here for the last 15 years or so, and this year's trip was to the Boundary Waters, and we had by far the most interest ever this year by our youth locally, and we took the largest group we ever have up north to the Boundary Waters because people are looking for safe activities, and a lot of those are related to the outdoors. This year, I personally, you know, noticed that there's a lot more turkey hunting pressure on the WPAs around the Wilmer area. And I've started taking a lot of calls on this coming hunting season. And in particular this year, what I'm finding interesting, I'm taking a lot of calls from people that want to know if they can mushroom hunt on WPAs. And a number of these people have told me that it's something that they feel they can do safely, and they've been thinking about getting into it for years, and this year is the year they're gonna try to do it. Outdoor activities have also been a bright spot in our local economy. Over 60 years of scientific research has proven that being outside in nature helps reduce stress hormones, high blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and premature death. Being in nature also lifts our spirits and helps us feel connected to something bigger. In these trying times, anything that lifts our spirits and helps with our mental health is very important. Thank you for your past support on the WPA Acquisition Program. In Minnesota, WPA Acquisition is focused in the southern and western portions of the state where public lands are often quite limited. It has always been important that people have an opportunity to get out of doors, but especially so during this COVID crisis. In many areas of Minnesota, public lands are limited, and the WPA program by its nature helps to improve opportunities for those that live in areas with limited public lands. Perhaps no time in recent history has it been more important than now for people to have access to those public lands. So I'll end it there and take questions if there are any.
Great, questions from the members? Mark?
Yep. Yeah, Mr. Chair, I guess just for the members to notice, I went through the acquisition list and the volume of these that are additions to existing units is the vast majority of the proposed acquisitions. I think that's a critical, the complexes that are going to be built by this is important.
Great, thank you. Other comments or questions? Seeing none, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Appreciate your work. Next, we will move on to WA02, Shallow Lake and Wetland Protection Restoration Program. John Schneider is coming back. And you can unmute yourself, John.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and council members. I'm John Schneider again from Ducks Unlimited. I'm here to present WA02 now with my colleagues, John Lindstrom, biologist based in Litchfield, and Doug McLean, biologist based in Fergus Falls. They help us deliver projects in southern and west central and northwest Minnesota. Again, we also have a team of 6 engineers that help us restore and enhance wetlands. As context for this proposal, I'd like to briefly review Ducks Unlimited's mission and duck needs in Minnesota. Ducks Unlimited conserves, restores, and manages wetlands and associated habitats for waterfowl. While goose and swan populations are doing well, ducks are more vulnerable to landscape changes due to their reliance on wetlands, especially in Minnesota. More than 20 species of ducks migrate through Minnesota each spring and fall, some of which stop to breed here too. Not as many as in the past, but some still do. Loss of breeding habitat and degraded migration wetland habitat are why we see fewer ducks in Minnesota than in past decades, along with the loss of prairie breeding habitat for those ducks that nest in upland areas. As mentioned earlier today, DU works to enhance shallow lakes and marshes for migrating ducks. However, for breeding ducks, we must strategically restore drained wetlands to add more breeding habitat to Minnesota's landscape. Most wetlands remain in northeast Minnesota, whereas over 90% wetlands have been lost in southwest Minnesota, which is also called the prairie pothole region. It's the duck part of the duck factory of North America. So this is where we focus our efforts to restore drained wetlands. Most of the drained but restorable wetland basins are on private land. So in order to restore them, we either need to ease them or acquire them in fee title. On Monday, you heard our proposal with Pheasants Forever and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to purchase and restore wetlands through conservation easements on private land. This proposal is phase 10 of our ongoing land acquisition and restoration program in southwestern Minnesota in partnership with the Minnesota DNR, through which we focus on land for sale with drained wetlands that must be purchased in order to restore those wetland basins. Many public lands in southwest Minnesota are small fragmented patches of habitat surrounded by land with great restoration potential, some of which contain drained wetlands. Most public lands are simply too small to function optimally for breeding ducks, which science indicates needs at least 40% of a 4 square mile area in idle grass and wetland habitat for ducks to breed optimally. Some of these public lands are managed shallow lakes with just a thin ribbon of upland prairie habitat around them, which desperately need a wider buffer too. So strategically, we strategically focus on land adjacent to existing state WMAs with drained wetlands that we can buy and restore to make these existing public land patches bigger and better with more wetlands and prairie to function for breeding ducks and other wildlife. These areas are open to public as required. Attached are some maps of some example parcels. Through this program, DU strategically works with willing seller private landowners who have land with drained wetlands on or land on shallow managed lakes. We propose to purchase 1,500 acres, 300 acres of wetlands, 1,200 acres of prairie. We work with the DNR section of wildlife to identify land tracts for sale with drained pothole wetlands, then work with the private landowners to appraise and purchase, and we provide written notification to counties and townships at least 30 days prior to closing, which I tend to preface with a phone call to the county and township leaders too, to make that one-on-one contact verbally with them before they receive a letter from me. We purchase these lands directly, we take ownership briefly, and then we transfer the land to the DNR for inclusion in the state wildlife management area system, while we also restore then the wetlands and native prairie grasslands back to habitat for wildlife, most of which is poorly drained cropland or land that's been in the CRP. Regarding past progress, DU has spent nearly all of our 2015, 2016, 2017, and 2018 OHF grant funds and have exceeded our land protection goals and have only relatively small amounts remaining for restoration, much of which is underway literally right now. Of the 2019 appropriations, we've spent 61% of our land to buy 5 of the 6 tracts of land we planned, and we will be beginning restoration very soon. And of our 2020 appropriation that just began in July, we've already spent $1.2 million to purchase our first land parcel just south of Willmar this last week. And we have 3 other land parcels in progress. To give you a sense of the type of habitat we're buying and restoring through this program, we purchased recently in the last couple of years 5 tracts of land that totaled 1,188 acres. On that land, there were 145 wetland basins totaling 214 acres restored, about 20% of the land we purchased. To get the wetlands, we have to buy the upland areas around them. The ducks need that as well, but about 20% of the acres were restored back to water and wetlands. So in short, we focus on buying land with drained wetlands to help enlarge prairie wetland complexes in southwest Minnesota. We strive to spend our acquisitions fund quickly by planning ahead, and we move quickly into emphasizing wetland restorations. We will likely spend all of our current acquisition funds by the end of next year, and we'll be out of funds and in need of more funds to keep this land acquisition program going in the future. Thank you, Chairman Hartwell and members, and with that, I'll be happy to address any questions.
Questions from members? Denny. You're on mute, Denny.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Snyder, I'm wondering if you could expand on your work. You mentioned you reach out to the local leaders, I'm assuming county commissioners. What about, do you offer to them to come out and actually visit with them one-on-one and talk about the specific proposal and the effects of, on their tax, two things, effects on their tax base and the effects on water management, potentially positive water management, holding water back that so their fields may turn out or some of their constituent fields may turn out better. I just am wondering because you're concentrating this efforts out in the region where we have had a couple examples of county commissioners not happy with the purchase of the land. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Member McNamara and council members. Great question. Yes, what I do is I figure out who the county commissioner and township officials are for that area and call them directly before sending the letter of notification and have a conversation about what we're doing and offer to come out and meet them. More often than not, that simple conversation verbally is just really helps tremendously. It sets them at ease. We talk through any concerns they have. They really appreciate hearing from me. Once in a while, they do want to meet out in the field to take a look at what we're talking about. Usually the township officials know exactly where we're talking about, so we don't need to go to the field. Often the county commissioners are fairly familiar with the area as well, or they do some research and call me back. Sometimes we do go to the field and talk about those things. I always defer to the county and township officials, whatever they want me to do. If they want me to come to the meeting, we can have a formal conversation. More often than not, they like to have informal conversations. And we do, as to your point, talk about the water storage potential, flooding concerns they have, drainage concerns they have, how this, you know, I can't tell you how many times I've talked to a local elected official that says right out of the chute, oh yeah, I'm familiar with that area. It's really low and wet. That's a good place to buy and restore. You know, I mean, we're not targeting prime flat farm ground. You know, it's land with drained wetlands that in recent years is often difficult to farm. So we do exactly what you're saying, but I always defer to the local officials, how they'd like to have the conversation.
And Mr. Chair and Council and Member McNamara, just to follow up on that, as you guys remember from yesterday, I'm John Lindstrom, one of the biologists here. And I'm not going to get into specifics, but those conversations have actually led to both a township and a county partnering with us on those land acquisitions that we've then been able to leverage NACA small grants with that on each particular project brought us another $100,000 to help restore those properties.
Ron?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Snyder, I'm just curious, many organizations, Ducks Unlimited, Pheasants Forever, others, will acquire land and then they turn it over to DNR to manage. And so I sit here and say, wow, I wonder how much land can DNR actually manage, which is an open question. But two, what if you don't like the way DNR is managing a piece of ground that you have turned over to them? Do you have any recourse there?
Mr. Chairman and members of the council, that's a great question, Member Shara. Increasingly, we've tried to have some of those long-term management conversations with our DNR colleagues, even before appraising the land. I shared one situation with Chairman Hartwell a few months ago, ran into just to get some guidance and feedback from him. Tree removal is a good example where we may be thinking wetlands and shallow lakes and prairie restoration, which is what our appropriation is for, and we want to make sure we're on the same page as the manager. So we have those conversations, but to your point, there is no quote recourse, end quote. I mean, we trust our DNR colleagues tremendously. They're experts and professionals. And sometimes there's a little variance in views, but again, a conversation goes a long way to sort through that and make sure we're all on the same page. So far we haven't seen any long-term management concerns. Sure, we'd like to see things burned maybe or managed a little more intensively, but the reality is our agency partners are in both the DNR and Fish and Wildlife Service are strapped for budgets and manpower. And so that's where some of these other proposals really come in to help manage the land. We may buy a tract of land that, you know, 10 years from now, PF comes in and enhances to keep the trees at bay. And it's all a great big partnership. We're all pulling on the same rope.
Great. Other questions? If not, thank you, gentlemen. We'll move on to WA3 Rim Wetlands.
Thank you very much.
Sharon, you can take yourself off mute and go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Hartwell. Good morning, Chair Hartwell and council members. Again, Sharon Doucette, the easement section manager at Bowser, the section responsible for the Reinvest in Minnesota RIM conservation program. The RIM program has over 30 years of success with almost 8,000 easements and over 326,000 acres recorded or in process, something that I was proud to join about a year and a half ago now. I'm here today to provide a summary of the RIM Wetlands Phase 10 proposal. These, in particular, are RIM easements for the protection and restoration of wetlands and adjacent uplands to enhance critical habitat for game and non-game wildlife. The proposal was a $10 million request for protection and restoration on approximately 2,000 acres. These easements will provide permanent protection on private lands, and the land stays on the tax roll while building permanent wildlife complexes that provide critical habitat for waterfowl and other wetland-dependent species. Like many of our easement programs, the program is delivered locally by the Soil and Water Conservation Districts. Typical sites for this program are currently drained and farmed wetlands and uplands adjacent to the wetland that offer little habitat or ecological value in their current state. As a reminder, most recent phases of the wetland program, phases 7 through 9, were used as a state match for CREP. We are not requesting funding for CREP with this proposal. All CREP funds have not been secured. There is an outstanding bonding request. But this proposal will return to a broader, more flexible state process with many of the same principles and the scoring criteria that we've been using with CREP. There is always demand for wetland restoration RIM easement signup options. For example, over 90% of the acres in our CREP applications have been wetland restoration conservation practice types. In particular, right now, there is demand for non-CREP options and wetland funding outside of the CREP area. It is possible if the enrollment cap in our agreement with USDA for CREP is not met yet, some of the funds could possibly still be utilized as part of a CREP easement application. The scoring and ranking process for this program allows for selection of the most impactful sites for wildlife habitat and includes site-specific criteria such as restorable basins on site and the amount of upland nesting habitat, as well as landscape scale criteria such as connectivity to existing permanent habitat, wildlife prioritization techniques, location within the prairie plan cores and corridors, nearby listed threatened and endangered species, proximity to an impaired water or a DNR public water, and if the area is directly linked to the goals of an approved comprehensive water plan, including one watershed, one plan. Scoring will also consider existing or expiring CRP acres. Important to note is for the first time, a similar wetland restoration program was proposed for inclusion in the Clean Water Fund budget. As this is a proposal for phase 9 of the buffer program, I wanted to provide a summary of previous phases' accomplishments. Phases 1 through 6, which are relatively old now, are complete and the final report submitted. Many of these phases were used as a match for our WRP partnership with NRCS. Those six phases had approximately $66 million and protected almost 24,000 total acres with federal funding. Phases 7 through 9 were the phases that were used as our CREP match, totaling about $34 million. Right now, over 9,400 acres are currently either recorded with that funding or are in process, including 2,000 acres that we've gotten in applications just since May and are not captured in our most recent status updates. The landowner easement payment budget in our internal budgeting is spent in all phases with applications received during 2020. Thank you, Chair Hartwell and members. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Mark?
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Sharon, again, could you, just for the group, the difference between this and CREP and what is CREP? So when we say this is non-CREP, what does that mean?
Sure. So CREP was our partnership, the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program, a partnership that we had with FSA. We had a agreement with them for, I believe starting in 2017, it was signed for up to 60,000 acres of a RIM easement combined with a 15-year CRP contract. So there was a pretty intensive push to secure the state funds for our match for that CREP program. These funds would be returning to our traditional RIM signup that don't include a CRP contract and follow the CRP guidelines and conservation practice requirements.
Jamie?
Thank you. So yeah, I remember previous proposals or previous phases for the project and having, I recall an impressive match and urgency, which I believe was tied to the CREP and the WRP partnership for match. And so the difference in this phase is that phase 10 does not have that same urgency or that same match as the previous phases. Is that correct?
Thank you, Member Swenson, Chair Hartwell. Yes, so this phase would be a return to a RIM only. So there is no federal match with this phase as proposed currently. For the first time ever, we are requesting similar funds from the Clean Water Council to provide additional wetland restoration funds. The urgency, I believe, is always there with our wetland restoration conservation easements. As I mentioned, 90% of our applications for CREP have been a wetland conservation practice.
Other questions? If not, thank you very much, Sharon.
Thank you.
We will move now to WA04, Wetland Habitat Protection and Restoration Program. Wayne Osley. You'll eventually connect, Wayne.
Can you hear me?
Can hear you.
Okay.
Wayne is still connecting for some reason. Wayne, you might turn off your video and see if that helps you connect faster. There you go. Unmute yourself and go ahead.
Council Chair Hartwell, council members, good morning. I'm Bev Rinke, Wetland Program Manager with Minnesota Land Trust. Joining me is Wayne Osley, Director of Land Protection, Amelia Kino, our Restoration Project Coordinator, and Sheldon Meyerchen, the Partners for Fish and Wildlife Program Coordinator for the state of Minnesota. Our Wetland Habitat Protection and Restoration Program is focused on the protection and restoration of wetlands and prairies within the famed Prairie Pothole region of west central Minnesota, also known as North America's Duck Factory. To date, the Minnesota Land Trust has been the recipient of 5 OHF grants focused on the protection and restoration of these wetland resources. Our program utilizes a competitive, market-based approach to conservation easements, targets high-quality areas with an emphasis on building habitat complexes, and brings restoration and enhancement into the equation through a partnership with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. This is our program niche. In every sense of the word, this is a public-private partnership with funding provided by the state of Minnesota, conservation easements procured and restored by Minnesota Land Trust and Fish and Wildlife, and active participation of private landowners. This latter piece, the partnership with landowners, can't be understated. Landowner interest is considerable and growing. In our last RFP, over 60 landowners submitted applications for conservation easements. We have a waiting list of 35 restoration projects already identified for next year's proposal, and that's above and beyond what was submitted in this year's proposal. Across all 27 conservation easements completed to date, landowners have contributed in excess of a $1 to $1 dollar match to state funds in terms of easement value to the program. That equates to $2.8 million over the first 3 phases of our program. Due to significant action over the last six months, we provided an updated results to date table. We've completed the first 2 grants. Across these 2 grants, we completed 23 conservation easements, protecting nearly 3,000 acres of habitat and over 30 miles of shoreline. Landowners contributed nearly $1.6 million in easement value to the program. Phases 3 and 4 are well underway. We've completed 4 conservation easements with 7 in process, which together exceeds the amount of funding that we have available. Already we have leveraged grant funding in the amount of $1.2 million in easement value donation. On the restoration and enhancement side, we have 15 projects totaling 1,638 acres well underway. We are on pace to meet and exceed all of our program deliverables. So our current proposal seeks to build on this success. We are proposing to protect 2,600 acres of habitat and 1,184 acres of restoration and enhancement. We will continue to focus on protection of private lands through a competitive, market-based approach to conservation easements. And our request is based on the amount of landowner interest and the quality of projects that are coming forward to us. The Land Trust is collaborating with the Fish and Wildlife Service to accelerate habitat restoration on both MLT and Fish and Wildlife easements. This will include 26 easements totaling about 1,800 acres. The priority in these restoration and enhancement projects will be to restore the hydrology of drained wetland basins and the restoration and enhancement of diverse native prairie mix in the upland areas. Together, this provides critical habitat complexes for wildlife. Thank you so much for the opportunity to present, and we are open for questions.
Great. Members, do you have questions? Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bev, you stressed multiple times the competitive market-based bid approach. Help me and the members understand what that allows you to do or not do versus the fee structure set up by the government.
So, always ecological significance of the project comes first. But a second major factor that we use is our consideration. We strive to make the greatest conservation impact with the most efficient use of state funds. And so we look at the overall cost of each project relative to its ecological significance, and we ask landowners to consider donating all or some of their easement value to better position their proposal. That means if two proposals come up with generally very similar ecological significance, but one is willing to donate some or all of the easement value, that would accelerate that proposal.
And other questions? Bev, I've always referred to that strategy as kind of a reverse auction. You know, where you've got criteria for what's important, but then, you know, those that will do the deal for the least amount are the ones that win, and it's a win for us as well.
Yeah, and that doesn't mean that other landowners won't be considered. It just means that perhaps someone might get their proposal done first, or it may mean that that is the proposal that we do.
So Council Chair Hartwell, council members, let me chime in a little bit as well on that. And so typically we see if there's projects that come to the mix that are really exceptionally ecological projects, they build on complexes, they're of high quality, we'll typically do those whether there's a donative element to them or not, just because they are those types of projects where we want to pursue them for their own ecological sake. In other environments, as Bev mentioned, you know, when there's equal projects in terms of ecological quality, yeah, then the donative piece tends to incentivize us to work with those. We've seen and kind of, we developed this program in the Avon Hills. We've moved it now statewide throughout our respective programs, and it seems to be working no matter where we are in the state. Certainly there's variability in terms of the amount of donative value we do get into the equation. But and what we see now through, I think we've done 121 conservation easements using OHF funds to date. And in terms of overall leverage, that equates to about $16.2 million of landowner donation into the equation across all of our programs. It's pretty significant. And one thing that I think we really want to emphasize here is the role of private landowners that are putting their resources into the equation to really make these things happen. We feel that is a very important piece of this whole equation.
Other questions? Great, Jamie. I almost missed you.
Yeah, just last minute there. Maybe this is more of a question for staff, but figured I'd ask it now. Can you help me understand why the project is a WA project compared to a PA project? I look at the total acres and see approximately 97 well in acres, and then 1,700 prairie acres, and then 2,600 habitat acres. What makes it fit into this category as far as comparing to other projects?
Did you want to jump in on that, Wayne? Or
I can certainly respond to that. So Commissioner Hartwell, Council Member Swenson, Council Members. I don't know the kind of the internal decision-making process in terms of what gets slotted to prairie versus wetlands, but I will say you'll see that fairly large number under habitats here. for this program. Some of our other programs are in that boat as well. And that was a conscious decision of ours that goes a fair bit back in history where, you know, as we adopted this RFP market-based approach, we didn't know what the types of projects were that were coming, that would come down the pike. And so would these be wetland? Would these be prairie? You know, we just didn't know. And so we tended to keep it in this more generic habitat bucket. So that's kind of the rationale why you see a fairly large number in that habitat category.
So in other words, it's a little bit arbitrary, Jamie. Yeah. That answer your question?
Yep, thank you.
Great. Thanks, any other questions? Great, well, thank you all. Thanks for your work.
Thanks.
We will move on to WAO5, Wild Price Shoreland Protection. Dan Stewart. Dan, you're showing up without video, but you're not muted, so you can start. Anytime. Dan, are you there? We can't hear you. Appear to have some technical challenges here. We'll give them another minute and then we'll move on and come back if necessary. Dan, are you there? All right, great. We can't see you, but go ahead and begin.
Okay, thank you. My name's Dan Stewart, and I work for the Board of Water and Soil Resources out of the Brainerd office. And thank you for the opportunity to talk a little bit about our Phase 7 wild rice shoreline protection proposal. I think it's pretty well established that wild rice is a very high quality habitat, especially for migrating waterfowl during their spring and fall times of when they're really expending a lot of nutrients in migration. It's important for lots of other birds, both game and non-game, trumpeter swans, oven birds, rails, etc. And then of the game species that wild rice is especially important for, I would say ringneck ducks, mallards, and blue-winged teal. And one way to think about maybe the importance of these rice beds as offering a very high nutrient content food source is I understand a lot of Minnesota's ringneck ducks winter off the Georgia coast. And so if you can just think about the condition they're in after that flight from Georgia, coastal Georgia up to northern Minnesota in the spring, they're pretty depleted, they're tired, and rice beds offer a unique high-quality food source where they can relatively rapidly regain strength, whether they're going to nest in Minnesota or move up into Manitoba, as many of them do. And so the legislature's long recognized the unique state legacy that wild rice is, and they've named it the state grain accordingly. And Minnesota is the epicenter of the world's remaining wild rice naturally occurring areas. And so we do have a unique responsibility for this great plant. I want to thank the council for their support over the years. This is the Phase 7 proposal. Our Phase 7 request is for $2 million. We have a goal set for this proposal from 1,000 acres and 6.5 miles of wild rice shoreline protected. In this particular proposal, it's all conservation easement money. We coordinated with DNR Wildlife, but they were not aware of any high-quality parcels that would fit within standards for their fee title acquisitions. So this one is focused on conservation easements. To date, the program has accomplished 73 wild rice easements, and they together add up to 4,999 acres. And so we want to get a little publicity. The next easement that gets recorded will push us over that 5,000 acre landmark, and we think that's quite an accomplishment that we can all be proud of. I know we're very proud of the districts and the 14 SWCDs that do most of the work on wild rice. As they had to build the program from nothing, it required a lot of marketing work because the RIM program was not well known in northern Minnesota when the council started this project back in, I think it was 2011. So with that, I don't have a whole lot more to offer other than we search out through a technical committee process and with a scoring sheet those easements that offer the greatest public benefit and proceed accordingly. And with that, I would stand for questions. Thank you.
Members, any questions? Tom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dan, this has been a great year for wild rice. Maybe a good year to sell easements. What are some of the things that you do when you get a hold of a good piece of easement? Is there any restoration involved at all?
So far, Mr. Chair, council member, so far we haven't had to do a lot of restoration. There haven't been a lot of open converted lands that have been deforested adjacent to these wild rice areas. There is the potential for that. I think as we move further west into areas like Otter Tail County and Becker County, we'll probably see a little bit more of that adjacent restoration. But so far there hasn't been too much of that.
Very good, thanks.
Great, Dan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stewart, I apologize. I had to step away from my computer. There was someone came to my door here at the house, and I missed your point about the migration from coastal Carolina up to the rice beds and so forth. What birds were doing that? I'm just curious.
Ringneck ducks in particular.
Okay. And thank you, Mr. Chair. And then what are they feeding on when they migrate in the rice beds?
Well, they're feeding on the rice. I mean, they get the rice is this time of year right now. I understand council member Saxog is correct. We had a very good rice crop this year, but we had some high winds down here in the Brainerd area in the last few days. And so much of that rice this year, I think, is going to go unharvested, at least by humans. And it's sitting on the bottom now. So there'll be more very heavy, good feedings, I would think, for migrating waterfowl. So that right. It varies a lot from year to year, whether there's a strong crop or a weak crop, and then what harvesting conditions are like at this time of year, and so on. So it's a really difficult thing to track, as it tends to swing a lot from year to year.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Thank you. And maybe my question wasn't worded very well. I was under the impression that the migration that was coming up there from coastal Carolina was in the spring, from what you had said. And I'm just wondering about the wild rice and the stuff. It's obviously just laying on the bottom and they dive down to get that. Is that correct? That's what I want a clarification on.
Yes, sir.
From the previous year.
Yes.
All right. Thank you. That was it. Just make.
Denny?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Stewart, interestingly, my wife and I went for a canoe ride a couple days ago up the Hay Creek from Lower Hay to Upper Hay, and we didn't go 1,000 feet, and there were three different canoes with two people in them cultivating wild rice. It was on Saturday, so that was interesting, and it did look like a bumper crop. My question is, when I look at your program, you mentioned 6.5 miles, 1,000 acres. I think I did a real quick calculation. Are these easements just narrow along? Because the wild rice is in the water, it's not on the land. But can you just tell me why do you secure an easement on the land to protect the water? I know that, I think I know what you're gonna say, but I wanna hear it. And then why are the easements actually that narrow as a few feet? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Council Member McNamara, yes, we tend to take, most of the easements are parcel-based, you might say. So if there's a 40-acre tract there, if the landowner is interested in putting in the whole tract, the whole 40, you know, that's generally what will happen. And so they're not really narrow strips. They reach back to try to keep that area pristine, quiet, you know, and undeveloped. As the human activity increases around the rice bed, it starts to degrade, depending on the how strong or what type of development there might be. And so the easements tend to be parcel based, if that helps.
Mr. Chair, if I could have a follow up, thank you.
Sure, go ahead.
So, Mr. Stewart, is the easement 100% no development, so no build it, basically? Is it no buildings built on the easement, and then no roads built also? Just what does the easement actually require?
It's, Mr. Chair, Council Member, yes, it's primarily no building. Timber management, for example, is allowed on the other side of things with the forest management plan. So that use is left with the landowner, and but buildings are the main thing that are restricted.
Great. Other questions? All right. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you very much.
We'll move on to FA01, Southeast Minnesota Protection and Restoration.
Mr. Chair, Dan Fabian here.
Yes.
I've got that Environment Committee meeting coming up now, too, in just a few minutes, so I'm probably going to be checking off here pretty soon.
All right. You can watch the tape later, I guess.
Thank you. Thank you.
As do I, Mr. Chairman.
All righty, we'll see you both later. Do good work. There you go. Go ahead and present, Richard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to introduce the team we have on here today. My name is Rich Biskey. I'm the Freshwater Program Director for the Nature Conservancy in Minnesota. I'm joined by Nick Banks with the Minnesota Land Trust, Haley Goals with the Minnesota Land Trust, Bob McGilvery and DJ Forbes with the Trust for Public Land, and Wayne Osley with the Minnesota Land Trust. I want to start, Mr. Chair and members, by thanking you for the opportunity to present today and update you on some significant progress that we've made in the program in Southeast Minnesota, not just in recent years, but in recent months, and to explain the difference that your investments have made, and then share more about how we're actually changing a few things moving forward to focus on implementation of restoration enhancement. So I want to start with kind of reinforcing the partnership goals, and that is to effectively conserve priority habitat complexes throughout Southeast Minnesota that allow for the restoration and enhancement at a landscape scale, increasing public access for hunting, fishing, bird watching, and other recreation through fee title acquisition, but also protecting critical habitat complexes and corridors with conservation easements, and performing ecologically sound restoration and enhancement. We use a targeted approach supporting the state conservation plans in conjunction with stakeholders that we work with closely, well beyond the partners that are in this partnership. So starting with kind of what's been done. So far with Outdoor Heritage Funds, the partnership's made a significant impact throughout the region in using strategic investments in these complexes that support the State Wildlife Action Plan, the Forest Action Plan, and local efforts. These investments meet the interest of our partners within the region by increasing public access and make it possible for diverse habitats across ownership boundaries, whether they be state or private conservation easements, to restore prairie savannas and maintain them with prescribed fire. The program has exceeded the proposed outcomes and continues to deliver on the conservation results and has demonstrated a demand and an opportunity that significantly exceeds the funds that have been awarded to date. Our results include over nearly 4,500 acres of fee ownership acquired, along nearly 15 miles of cold water trout streams, over 3,000 acres of high quality habitat, along nearly 10 miles of trout stream protected through conservation easements, and about 1,200 acres of prairie and forest restoration and enhancement activities that include clearing bluff prairies, floodplain forest planting, prairie restoration, and oak savanna enhancement. Beyond the acres conserved, it's important to note that how these programs built and protected complexes of high quality habitat. In addition to protecting and enhancing the public lands, we've leveraged nearly $500,000 of federal funding to conduct restoration enhancement work on state and private lands within these complexes. We're waiting on an additional $250,000 to continue that work and expand prescribed fire working with state and private landowners. These actions are directed to lands adjacent to those proposed in this and previous OHF supported sites. And to date, this program has leveraged over $4 million of private and federal funding, including over $1.2 million from landowner donations. From the handout, you can see examples of how this program is protecting, enhancing, and restoring some complexes near Rushford, Minnesota. So in the handout, there's an image of an area north of Rushford and south of Rushford. These places have become, have drawn and become recreation destinations. So one track that we required actually within weeks of last year's appropriation to show you is how we're spending the money quickly, had 16 vehicles on it the first weekend. We're meeting the demand for this area. The complexes also show how we're using the three different approaches of acquisition, restoration, enhancement, and easements on targeted areas being efficient and effective for public and private lands. Moving forward, the proposal in front of you this year reflects an increased demand from our landowners seeking conservation easements. And within these habitat complexes and the need for conservation action. In addition to the committed funds from the previous appropriations, our goal is to continue to work to conserve the region's most valuable complexes. Through protection, we request to complete an additional 3,400 acres of protection. Many of these parcels are adjacent to these tracts that we've mentioned. We're also going to increase the amount of restoration enhancement we're doing this year. And that includes working with more contractors, but also our own staff to do prescribed fire and forest treatments to the tune of about 1,300 acres. And we're also going to continue to seek federal funding to expand this, to work with our partners and leverage the federal funds available as we have in the past. In summary, the partnership is working well in the region of Minnesota that desperately needs additional protection and enhancement. We now have the opportunity in the coming year to make a significant impact in the region. And with your support, we can. With that, we welcome any questions you may have.
Great, thank you. Questions? Danny.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to make a comment. It's impressive in how quickly they get the money on the ground. Where some of the proposers take a longer time to get the affected property owners' contracts taken care of and the money spent. This one's got a track record of really spending the money quickly. Thank you.
Great. Other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yep.
Mark Holston, I noticed in the acquisition list, the Olmsted County Root River Forestry was 40 acres for almost $1 million. I just wanted a clarification on that. It just seemed excessive. So I didn't know if it was a typo or if there's something special going on there.
Rich, can you unmute yourself and let us know?
I'll direct that to Trust for Public Land.
Mr. Chairman, Member Holston, this is Bob McGilvery with the Trust for Public Land. That property is listed for sale, and that is the listing price. We, of course, would not pay more for it than it appraises for, and I think there is a substantial chance that it may appraise for less than that.
Other questions? Great, thank you, gentlemen, and Haley.
Thank you.
We will move on. Next is FAO 2, Minnesota Forests for the Future, Christine Ostern. You need to unmute yourself and go ahead. Christine, you need to unmute yourself. There you go. Go ahead. We're not hearing you, Christine.
How about now? Yep. Can you hear me?
You're just fine. Go ahead.
Oh, good. Thank you, Chair Hartwell. Council members, it is my pleasure to be here this morning to speak to you about our proposal for the Minnesota Forest for the Future Phase 8. My name is Christine Ostern. I've been working in this role as the coordinator for the Forest Legacy Program, Forest for the Future Program, in the Division of Forestry, DNR, for about a year and a half. I took over after Richard Peterson, longtime program leader, retired in 2018. Our program works with willing landowners to purchase conservation easements and property and fee in order to protect large blocks of working forest and important habitat. Land that is protected through these voluntary easements stays in private ownership. We work with partners to reach landowners and to identify, prioritize, and fund projects. One of the partnerships we are currently growing is working with the Board of Water and Soil Resources and County Soil and Water Conservation Districts to implement protection strategies identified in watershed planning work in order to meet regional watershed needs within the larger context of our overall state program. We also continue to work with our non-governmental organization partners to coordinate our protection efforts, both at the regional scale and statewide. The Forest Legacy Program, a federal program which we coordinate within the state of Minnesota, is a complementary program to the Minnesota Forest for the Future program, providing staffing dollars and match for projects. Since the year 2000, our program has protected over 360,000 acres in easement and over 9,000 acres of property and fee. Our program in the Division of Forestry comprises only 4% of the total number of easements held by DNR, but over 92% of the total acres held in easements by DNR. To date, our protection efforts have an appraised value of over $88 million. With a purchase price of approximately $85 million.
The total funds we have received over the history of our program is $92 million. Of that, 62% has come from state sources, 18% from federal, and 20% from private. Next, I'd like to speak about the public benefits our program, which are many. 99% of our easement acres provide public access for hunting, fishing, hiking, and other recreational uses. Our conservation easements and property and fee keep large blocks of forest intact, protecting habitat and keeping watersheds healthy. Our working forest conservation easements help sustain the regional timber-based and tourism economies by protecting the land base and providing public access. Easement properties are managed using sustainable forest management.
It looks like we lost Christine. Christine, unmute yourself.
There we go. Am I back?
We lost you for a second and you're back. Great.
Okay. I think I'll just keep going though. Our request for funding for phase 8 of the Minnesota Forest for the Future program is for $8,417,600, which will be used to purchase working forest conservation easements on 3,210 acres and to purchase 660 acres of property and fee from private landowners. Our programs are offered statewide and are very popular. Over the last year, we received requests from interested landowners for properties with high conservation value for a total of approximately 25,000 acres of conservation easement and property and fee for an estimated acquisition value of approximately $22 million. We worked to reduce that to our current request of just over $8 million. The projects we are proposing are located across the state in Becker, Cass, Crow Wing, Hubbard, Morrison, Rice, Sherburne, and St. Louis counties. The emphasis of our request is purchasing conservation easements, and the main portion of those are located in the Northern Forest in Becker, Cass, Crow Wing, Hubbard, Morrison, and St. Louis counties. That concludes my prepared presentation. I would be happy to take any comments and answer any questions at this time that the council has for me. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Questions? Apparently it's fairly straightforward, Christine. Thank you very much. Or no, Mark has a question.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. Christine, looked at the last or past appropriations, and I know we're going to review an updated list later, but this list shows a lot of revenue from previous years that you're still holding on to that haven't been spent.
Yes, I think you'll see in the updated status updates and the final reports that we are catching up with that. We had a lot of projects close at the end of our fiscal year and at the end of this past June, and I'm in the process of submitting some final reports through the new online site that you all have. So yes, and I think that can be explained fairly straightforwardly by the gap in staffing that we had between Richard Peterson retiring and then me coming on board about a half a year after that. And then it took me some time to get up to speed and get caught up with some of the work.
Mr. Chair?
Yep.
I recognize that. That's what I was expecting to hear, but good. In looking at this and thinking back over the years of this program, this one looks like there's a lot of small scattered parcels versus what I've seen in previous years. Do you have a comment to that?
Yeah, I think the trend is going to be more that way in the future. In the past appropriations and some of the past projects, we really tackled some of the large industrial forest ownership. And so, you know, we have purchased easements on a lot of that property already. And so I think going forwards, we're going to see more of the smaller pieces, and they may look scattered on the map right now, but they're actually, you know, fairly adjacent to some other protected properties that we already own easements on or that are protected in other ways. So we're trying to make sure that we're addressing that adjacency component of our projects.
Okay. Jamie.
Thank you. I see in previous years, the funding, or there was a leverage from Wild Turkey Federation and the Minnesota Deer Hunters. Why is there no leverage included or funding from partners this round?
Yes, on this proposal, thank you. The only leverage that we included was through our federal partner, the Forest Service, with our Forest Legacy Program, the complementary federal program. And that was the only leverage that we included. I understand that that is a point that we can improve upon on future requests and future work. Again, I think part of that is me coming on board, being a new person, a new face, and needing a little time to develop some of those same relationships that my predecessor had, and just having the capacity to get around and to make these connections. I will say that just recently we applied for some additional funding for this program through a federal source through NRCS, and we partnered with multiple local county soil and water conservation districts, the Bowser Board of Water and Soil Resources, and some other partners involved. So we're trying to increase our capacity for leverage. I think we definitely can do that, and we'll be doing that in the future. Thank you.
Yes, thank you for the honest and straightforward answer, Christine. I really appreciate that.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Great, Christine. Thanks very much. Oh, Tom.
Thank you so much.
Sorry. Wait a second. Tom, go ahead.
Hey, you know, Mr. Chair, I was just going to make a comment. Sometimes the larger parcels of land, particularly in the Northeast, as she's already pointed out, we've already taken the Potlatches and the Blandons off the table with the things that we've done, but the smaller pieces, as you probably look at them, are going to alleviate fragmentation, which I consider to be the biggest single threat to the forests of northern Minnesota. So small pieces and conservation easements that are small but strategic, I think, is what she's talking about and are key. Thank you.
All right. Now, Christine, thank you very much.
Thank you all very much. Thank you. Have a good day.
We'll move on to FA03, Camp Ripley Sentinel Landscape. Shannon Wetstein. There, Shannon, can you hear us? Shannon, are you there? We can see you. We can't hear you.
Shannon, we cannot hear you. It doesn't look like you're muted, but we can't hear you. So you must have a microphone issue somehow. There, unmute yourself now, and I think we'll be able to hear you.
Okay, that little button was hidden for a while.
All right.
I feel Christine's name.
So we're getting a little feedback. If you've got anything else going on, if you can turn it off, that might help.
Is that better, Mr. Chair?
A little bit, yes, thank you.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, council members. My name is Shannon Webstein, and I'm the district manager for the Morrison Soil Water Office here in Morrison County. And I am one of the partners that is privileged enough to present our proposal to you today, which is Camperley Sentinel Landscape Phase 9 proposal to secure conservation easements within a 5-mile boundary of Camp Ripley. But first of all, let me describe Camp for those of you in the room here. It's located along the northern stretch of the Mississippi, and it's a primary National Guard training facility for not only Minnesota, but North Dakota, South Dakota, Wisconsin, Ohio, and Illinois. It employs 800 full-time staff and generates over $300 million in the local economy. It's located in central Minnesota, right between Little Falls and the Brainerd-Baxter area. Surrounding camp is primarily ag and forested lands, which has enabled the installation to conduct aircraft, live fire, artillery, IED, and winter training with limited restrictions. But as you can imagine, incompatible land uses and development near camp could restrict this in the future. So thinking about you guys, you have a lot of similarities between the goals and the vision of camp. First of all, you want to protect natural resources, protect habitat, and ultimately the species and inhabited landscape. You want to temper fragmentation and to protect the water from contamination. You also want to see multiple uses on this landscape because it's been built with taxpayer money and legacy dollars. You want to see outdoor opportunities for citizens. We've included a handout with this proposal today that shows a myriad of opportunities available for private citizens on these lands. And you both want to see success. Our program has a 14-year history of building what started as just a vision to today what's a reality with an end state in grasp. There are over 20 partners working together to achieve the goals of the Camp Ripley Sentinel Landscape. And we consider the Lasard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council to be an important partner. You've entrusted us in the past with over $14 million, which we've executed over the years. This has enabled the Camp Ripley Sentinel Landscape to leverage an additional $42 million of federal funds, which advance these same goals. Your continued support for our 9th proposal would allow at least 22 more permanent conservation easements to be secured. Parcels are ranked, they're prioritized, and done in a process that's open and transparent. These easements will continue to expand existing habitat corridors for fish, game, migratory birds, and forested habitat along riparian areas of the Crow Wing, Mississippi, Long Prairie, Nokasippi, and rivers within a 5-mile radius of camp. Last time I was here, you guys supported a project which now has brought together 6,000 acres of permanently protected lands was a combination of public lands and private protected easements, and something that we should all be proud of and showcases what this program can do on the landscape. We have the support of our county commissioners and our city officials in Cass, Crow Wing, and Morrison counties where these easements would be located. We also have a state and federal designation that leads to the prioritization of federal resources on this landscape. And of course, our landowners, they do not want to see their lands parcelized. They do not want to sell out for development. We have over 250 interested and waiting landowners that are willing to participate in this program. ACUB is important for CAMP. Everyone understands that. But the success of ACUB is just as important for this council and something that you can be very proud of. The model that inspires not only Minnesota, but the rest of the nation. So I'm here today to ask for your continued support. I hope that you can see the jewel that we have created. It's on the flyer in front of you that we've provided, and the map behind me where you can see what has been done on this landscape. I see it, and I hope you can too. Please take some time to review the handout. It provides detail on the species that we're helping to protect, the opportunities that are available for the public, the leverage you've helped secure, and the map that shows all of the habitat we've secured for Minnesota's future. We would welcome questions, as I have our other partners here in the room with me today, Bill Penning with Bowser, Todd Holman from the Nature Conservancy, and Josh Pennington from Camp Ripley. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Great, questions? I had a question, just you're showing no leverage on your proposal. Why is that?
Mr. Chair, can I have Bill Penning answer that question?
Sure.
Yes.
Bill, you have to unmute yourself. There you go.
Okay, thanks. I'm having computer issues. That's a good question, Mr. Chair and members. As Shannon mentioned, we've actually had $42 million in leverage for this project over the years. At the time of application, we frequently do not know how much money will be coming in the next year, so we don't list that. And also the money that the National Guard Bureau, the federal government provides for this does not go into the exact same easements as the LSOHC dollars. So we've always struggled with how to show leverage or not show leverage. And we typically choose to be conservative and not show it in the tables, but talk about it within the narrative.
So what can we expect?
Mr. Chair?
Yeah?
Can I have Josh Pennington speak a bit further on that question?
Sure.
Hi, everyone, Mr. Chair and Council. So every year I submit a proposal to the National Guard Bureau their ACAP program. It's called the Readiness and Environmental Protection Integration Program. And state match or state leverage is a really critical factor in acquiring those federal funds, because as you know, all funding is very competitive, and this funding is competitive on a national level. So many other military installations are competing for this funding. So this year I submitted a proposal to the REPI program for $5 million. And with that, I showed that we could bring in a state match of no less than 25% to that $5 million. And as Bill Penning mentioned, we won't know if we're successful with that record proposal, but we have showed continued annual success with those funding. And a lot of that has contributed directly to our ability to bring in state dollars.
Mr. Chair and members, we also just signed an agreement for $500,000 on top of the money that Josh just mentioned.
And the way this funding is implemented, the Board of Water and Soil Resources has a special military cooperative agreement with the National Guard Bureau. So all funding is directly obligated to Bowser. And Bowser utilizes the RIM easement program to execute working land and habitat conservation easements throughout the authorized buffer around Camp Ripley.
Mark, did you have a question?
Mr. Chair, you got to the heart of what I was going to.
Okay. Other questions? Great. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Member, we're at 10 o'clock. We'll take a 15-minute break. We'll come back at 10:20. Officially, this is a recess, I'm told, not a break. And just to make sure you know, when you come back on, the video streaming is live. If you have a conversation, it does not get shut off. So everything you say will be captured. And we'll see you all back at 10:20. Your mail folder.
Okay, well, maybe we will just not do that then. Thank you, Mr. Chairperson and council members. My name is Andrew Beebe. I'm a forester with Audubon, Minnesota. Managing reed canary grass and growing new trees within the Mississippi River floodplain is challenging, but Audubon is achieving successes. While Audubon's work faces difficulties, if one asks the question, is Audubon getting results? I would answer with an emphatic, oh yeah, you betcha. To date, Audubon has planted over 100,000 trees. While traditional plantings still have their place, we now have developed a hybrid approach where we prepare soils for natural regeneration as well as planting and seeding trees. Through this new approach, we have regenerated another 100,000 trees, along with countless valuable flowering plants. Moreover, we have demonstrated a new management technique that is being adapted by our federal partners. I want to leave you with one takeaway point today. Audubon is successfully establishing new trees in the face of reed canary grass. Furthermore, each tree that we grow locks in habitat for over 100 years. Floodplain forests along Minnesota's reach of the Mississippi River are aging and experiencing natural tree death and decline as a result. Reed canary grass and other competing weeds are replacing trees as they die. This process slowly but surely leads to the formation of what I term a green desert, essentially dense vegetation that provides very little to wildlife, increases surface runoff and flooding, and prevents soils from breaking down fertilizers and pesticide residues. Floodplain forests are incredibly valuable to the people of Minnesota as well as Minnesota's wildlife. More than 300 species of birds utilize this habitat for nesting and throughout migration. Minnesotans spend tens of millions of dollars per year while visiting the Upper Mississippi River to hunt, fish, and birdwatch. On the Winona District alone, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service determined that in 2019, individuals spent between $40 and $70 million to recreate on the river. Birdwatching and nature viewing account for the largest portion of this spending. As forests decline, recreational capacity of the system likewise declines. These floodplain forests are beneficial to humans, wildlife, water quality, and sustainability alike. I wanted to take you through a quick five slides or five pictures that I have just demonstrating, I think, one of the better successes we've had in our floodplain forestry work. Maybe I can follow up with those pictures after this. But essentially, the pictures would show you a dense stand of reed canary grass that we have converted to 7,000 trees per acre, which is definitely a successful management technique. We've done that through this process of natural regeneration and tree seeding and tree planting. So we've actually prepared the soils, much as nature would have done historically before locks and dams were in place, allowed bare mineral soil to take place, just a blank slate of bare mineral soil, which then allows a seedbed for cottonwood, a silver maple, black willow, and other light-seeded tree species to seed into. So naturally, we're able to get thousands of trees per acre, and then add a little bit of mast seeding, acorns and walnuts, as well as some shrubs, kind of the right tree for the right place, and in the end, establish a very diverse, quite dynamic stand of floodplain forest trees. So hopefully I can get those pictures to you one way or another. I apologize that that didn't work today. Thank you very much for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great, thank you. Sorry for the technical challenge, but if you send the pictures to Amanda, she'll get them to all of us. Are there any questions? Yeah, Mark?
Andrew, share with me or the committee if conflict or problems that this has with Army Corps of Engineers.
I would say we don't have any conflicts with the Army Corps of Engineers. We're actually working hand in hand with the Army Corps. So St. Paul District, just out of La Crescent, Minnesota, we work very closely with them. We have a couple projects now where we have worked on Army Corps land as well as Fish and Wildlife land to kind of bolster projects that they had in planning stages, and we were able to go ahead and get those projects accomplished, and they were able to use their monies in other places and kind of just prioritize where spending is taking place.
Other questions? Matt, thank you very much, Andrew.
Thank you.
Sorry, I think we're moving to HA01, St. Croix Watershed Habitat Protection and Restoration, with Monica Zachary.
Yeah, all right, can you hear me okay?
Yep, you're okay. Great, thank you.
Yeah, fantastic, thank you. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for this opportunity to present to you all our St. Croix Watershed Habitat Protection and Restoration Program. I'm Monica Zaki, Director of Programs for the St. Croix River Association and Project Manager for this program. Today, I also have with me DJ Forbes, Project Manager with the Trust for Public Land, and Wayne Ostley, Director of Land Protection with Minnesota Land Trust. I'm excited to be here today to request funding for the second phase of the St. Croix Watershed Habitat Protection and Restoration Program. Phase one of the program is proving to be quite successful, and we are ready for our next step. The program is a partnership between the St. Croix River Association, the Trust for Public Land, and the Minnesota Land Trust. For phase two, the Trust for Public Land will work to protect approximately 690 acres in fee, and Minnesota Land Trust will protect approximately 900 acres of conservation easements. The St. Croix River Association will continue as project manager and will be conducting landowner outreach. As the first federally designated wild and scenic river national park in the country, the St. Croix River and its watershed is a treasure for Minnesotans and one we can all be proud of. The St. Croix River offers a truly wild experience within an hour's drive from the city, the Twin Cities metro area, and its clean flowing waters, rich wildlife, including its globally significant mussel populations and wealth of public access and use, are worthy of protection. Just a fun fact for you, the St. Croix River has 41 different species of freshwater mussels, 5 of which are federally listed as threatened or endangered. Researchers also believe that all of these mussel species found within the St. Croix River before European settlement are still present today. The federal protections over the St. Croix River only apply to a thin ribbon of land on either side of the river. Beyond that, approximately 75% of its watershed is in private ownership, and that means it's vulnerable to development, fragmentation, and conversion to higher intensity land uses. In 2019, our partnership received outdoor heritage funds to kick off one of the first protection programs dedicated solely to the St. Croix River watershed. Using existing data and management plans, combined with a bit of GIS analysis, we have identified priority areas to focus efforts for conservation easements and fee title acquisition. Once we began our landowner outreach in these priority areas, we quickly learned that Minnesotans in the St. Croix watershed are hungry for permanent protection options, with this being one of the first dedicated pools of funding for this work in the St. Croix. People have been waiting a long time for this opportunity, and their interest in the St. Croix program shows it. To date, our funding from phase one has been fully subscribed, and we have a waitlist of priority projects for conservation easements. Funds allocated for fee title acquisition will likely be spent by the end of this calendar year. As we continue with landowner and partner outreach, we anticipate that this interest in our program will only continue to grow. And I would like to highlight just a couple projects that we are particularly excited about. One is an addition to the Changuatana State Forest in northern Chisago County. The Trust for Public Land has been working to permanently protect over 700 acres in fee just off the St. Croix River and adjacent to the Changuatana State Forest. We expect this land to be acquired and conveyed to the Minnesota DNR by the end of this year. This large intact property has exceptional habitat qualities and will provide excellent outdoor recreational opportunities. Additionally, the Minnesota Land Trust recently completed a conservation easement project protecting over 150 acres, including over 1,400 feet of shoreline along Rock Lake near Pine City. This beautiful property includes a mix of high-quality native grassland, wetland, and mesic hardwood forest. Restoration and enhancement work on this project is underway, building off of previous work of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Projects like these capture, you know, we believe capture the essence and purpose of the Outdoor Heritage Fund to protect and enhance wetlands, prairies, forests, and habitat for fish, game, and wildlife for the benefit of Minnesotans. To keep our momentum growing, this year we are requesting an additional $8,295,000 in outdoor heritage funds to protect upwards of 1,600 more acres of high-quality wildlife habitat. The funding in the St. Croix is needed. We have priority lands identified, applications from landowners, and there is much more untapped potential. And really, we're just getting started. So with that, I thank you all for the opportunity to present our program. And DJ, Wayne, or myself would be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Great, are there questions? Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Monica, this is from a large mission perspective, not so much about this project, but the vast majority of St. Croix is in the Wisconsin side. What's happening over there? I don't know anything about what's happening in the upper reaches or the eastern side of the shore.
Yeah, so over half, it's about half and half. Half is in Minnesota and half is in Wisconsin. Our organization, we do cover the entire St. Croix. And so on the other side, we are working with our land trust. Landmark Conservancy is one that we're working with a lot of landowner outreach. Unfortunately, Wisconsin does not have the same funding support for projects, you know, of this magnitude, but most of it has to be individually, you know, private donations and fundraising, as well as there is a Governor Nelson Stewardship Fund, but a lot of the work that we do for land protection is on the Minnesota side with funding support from programs like these.
Jamie.
Thank you. I see about 8% leverage listed in the proposal. How much is of that is a cash match that's included with that leverage? Is there money coming from the association or other partners?
So some of our outreach funds, a small percentage is cash match from the River Association. Wayne and DJ, if you would like to speak a little bit about the match that you have pledged for the projects. And you're on mute, Wayne. And you're still on mute, Wayne.
How's that?
I'll go.
All right.
Go ahead, Wayne. I'll follow you.
So I will chime in. It probably does not get directly to your question. Land trust leverage is really coming in through landowner donation, so it's not a cash match per se. And so I don't know if that's getting to your question, but we do have a significant amount allocated as an estimate related to this program. I think what we're seeing is that that estimate is always a fairly conservative level because we need to and really want to hit that. It's an auditable number. And so our speculating on kind of where things will end up will be in excess of that. That's generally our track record. But DJ, if you have any additional comments on the cash leverage side of the equation.
Sure. Thanks, Chair Hartwell and Member Swenson. The leverage that TPL has provided is kind of cash in hand that we will be provided as match. And we are also conservative in terms of listing match in terms of leverage of fee title acquisition. You'll know that we actually have zero listed just because we are conservative and don't list things that we don't know for certain, but we are always looking to match either through a bargain sale from the landowner being willing to donate value or, you know, a private fundraising that could go to land acquisition or if working with the DNR, either with, you know, RIM match. So we're always seeking to leverage the OHF grant with additional funds, but are conservative in listing things on our proposal that we are not certain for. So thank you.
Council Chair Hartwell, council members, one other point I wanna make is that in Washington County, we do collaborate very closely on conservation easements with Washington County itself. Washington County does have their own land and water legacy program. And often we will co-hold conservation easements, co-fund conservation easements in Washington County. We do not have a parcel list per se, but we do envision a number of conservation easements occurring in Washington County. And if that's the case going forward, we will see definitely cash contributions towards the equation from Washington County on those projects that will likely equal what we put forward from the Outdoor Heritage Fund.
Sure. So just to clarify then, 0% of the 8% leverage listed in the proposal is from cash. However, you do see cash that's not included in the proposal because you're not sure what that is yet.
That is correct.
Okay, thank you.
Denny?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is in regard to the potential purchase of 82 acres adjacent to the Bayport WMA. I'm curious, when I look at the map of that WMA, it's surrounded by development for the most part, with the exception of one small field to the southeast and the gravel pit, I'm assuming, is what this looks like. Is this actually the gravel pit that you're expanding to? I'm curious if you could expound on what that is and what we're doing there. Thank you.
Chair Hartwell, Member McNair, I'd be happy to answer that. Yeah, so this is a potential addition to the Bayport WMA on the kind of south eastern unit of it. There are actually two units of the WMA, and this has been a priority parcel for some local land conservation groups in the area that has been brought to our attention. And there hasn't been a ton of conversation on it specifically. It's more kind of a really high priority for local constituents, and thought that it could be a great addition. And so it's not the gravel pit exactly. It's actually kind of adjacent to it. And apologize, I'm not looking at a map right now, so I can't explain it any better than that. But it is on that kind of southeastern unit, and would be happy to follow up offline and kind of talk you through exactly what parcel of land that is.
Mr. Chair, if I could do a follow-up.
Sure.
Thank you. It's McNamara again. I actually am looking at the photo, and it looks like it's the only, it's pretty much development other than that gravel pit to the northeast, and to the southeast, it looks like a field, and it could easily be the 80 acres that looks to the shape of an 80. I'm just curious, Mr. Forbes, what hunting is allowed there currently, and you said some locals wanted the purchase of that property. How has the hunting there gone along with all the developments? Looks like there's subdivisions on the wildlife corridor, must be the river. I'm just curious, $1 million for 82 acres. I'm trying to understand if you could expand. I think it's just small game hunting. Do they actually hunt deer with slugs in this WMA? Thank you.
Member Hartwell, Chair Hartwell, Member McNamara, great question. And I believe, if I'm not incorrect, I believe full hunting without restrictions is limited on the Bayport WMA. You know, I think it does become a question of conversation with local constituents and local units of government of the amount of hunting that folks feel comfortable on that in. You know, it would really be a conversation that, you know, if the project does move forward, that we would have in partnership with the Minnesota DNR in what they feel is the appropriate level of hunting on this. And then also, how does that work with in terms of proximity to, you know, development and all of that. But if I'm not mistaken, I do believe kind of unrestricted hunting is allowed on the current WMA, but I'm not 100% on that.
Mark, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I noticed in the documents, and I don't mean to single out TPL because I've noticed it in other proposals with different organizations, but I'm kind of curious where it goes on to say TPL will convey the lands to the DNR except when the LGU ownership is appropriate for permanent ownership, management, and stewardship. Okay, how is that determined and why? I don't mean to TPL because I have noticed other NGOs have the same deal, but this one I had underlined.
Member Chair Hartwell, Member Holston, no, it's a great question, and you know a lot of it is context driven, and so you know if a piece of property that is worthy of conservation is adjacent to you know, an existing WMA, kind of adding to that WMA really makes the most sense from a management perspective. When we start to have these conversations as an organization, talking both to the landowner and our public partners, both at the DNR and local units of government, let's use Washington County for an example, because we actually are working on a project where the county would be the public steward. It's having those conversations of, does this fit in your management policies, for lack of a better term? Are you interested in managing this long term? And we really, you know, we've developed those relationships over the long term, and it's really talking through what makes the most sense from a permanent protection standpoint. And so it's really case by case and context specific based on geography, interest in the public partner to manage that land, whether it is a priority or not. And so, as I'm sure you're aware, different, you know, divisions within the DNR have different interests and pieces of land, and let alone with county government or local units of government as well. And so it's really working through that on a case-by-case basis, and would be more than happy to kind of talk about that in more detail on a specific project if you're, you know, interested. But I hope that answers your question.
All right, Jamie, you get the last question.
Sure, thank you. Let's see. So I see that the majority of the watershed is within counties or areas with over 25% state lands, and the St. Croix has the protection of the Wild and Scenic River Program. What makes this proposal more critical than others, or what? How will this proposal define success as a project?
All right. You want me to take that one, Wayne and DJ?
Sure. Sure.
Yep. Fantastic. So what makes the St. Croix, we believe, a little bit more unique is that, you know, a lot of it is still in very good condition, you know, and so believing that an ounce of protection is worth more than a pound of cure, we just... Success, you know, of this, you know, is can look at, or sorry, if you can't tell, I'm a little nervous. You know, I look at DJ and Wayne and they're just pros after I'm hearing they're like phase, you know, 3, 4, 5, and this being my second. So I think we really have a unique opportunity with the St. Croix, and a lot of times, you know, we hear people saying that the St. Croix is so important, is so important, is so important, and, you know, not having these funds and dedicated funds for this type of protection in such a critical area, it's just, it's really time. And so working with TPL and MLT, you know, being able to connect, you know, some of these high quality areas. We've got state lands, some WMAs, you know, our priorities, we're looking at connecting some of those so we reduce that habitat fragmentation. And I think as much work that we can do, you know, in the St. Croix, and of course I'm a bit biased, is really important. Wayne and DJ, if you have anything to add to that, that sounds a little bit more fluent, you know, go for it.
Chair Harwell, Commission, our council members, it's Wayne Ostley. Building out what Monica said as well, you know, this is a very important river to the state, to the upper Midwest, to the nation. It does provide, you know, if you look at the broader kind of Mississippi flyway as it kind of moves through kind of the Minnesota Twin Cities metro area, it's a very important connector between the Mississippi River and the habitat and the upland forests, the south, and as well as the northern forests. And so it's heavily used by migratory birds. Monica mentioned a lot in terms of the water quality of the stream and rivers. It's in really excellent condition. It's recognized, you know, federally because of that and because of the resources. Up until the last proposal that we submitted and was funded, this, you know, there had not been really a dedicated program pulled together like the St. Croix River Association has to leverage some of the outdoor heritage funds towards that program area. And it's really important to, I think our long-term goal is sustain the quality and the excellent habitats, but also the quality of the streams and rivers in that geography at their current level. Yeah, and so there is a fair bit of protection, especially as you go into the northern portions of the watershed. That's extremely important that we have that base to build from. But frankly, as you go south, that base isn't there. And so we need to put some additional resources into the equation to ensure that, you know, high priority upland habitats, but also the streams and rivers that feed into the St. Croix are maintained and enhanced.
Okay. Ron, do you have a quick question? Otherwise, we're going to move on because we're running late on this. You're on mute, Ron.
I'm sorry about that. It is a quick question, maybe more of a statement. I too am concerned about spending $1 million for 82 acres to add to the Bayport WMA. I looked it up. There's the only deer hunting allowed is with bow and arrow, which is fine. Otherwise, only shotguns with a fine shot is allowed there. And in part of their same proposal, they have 62 acres they'd like to buy for $150,000 up in the Carlos Avery area. So 62 acres for $150,000 is a lot more reasonable than $1 million for 82 acres. I just don't understand the thinking there. I think that $1 million could be used better. So it's more of a statement, but if Wayne likes to reply, I'd appreciate that. Thanks.
I don't think this is a Wayne question. DJ, do you want to answer that?
Sure. Chair Hartwell, Member Shara, thank you for the question. I mean, it's a great example of the varying values of land throughout the watershed. I mean, the one near the Bayport WMA is very adjacent to the river, and you know, that is the assessed value. So all of our parcels listed on our list, we are not anticipating working on all of them. We know from experience that some of these fall through for a number of reasons, you know, landowner-ness, realistic expectation, availability of funds. And so this was one, the Bayport, for example, that came up that was a priority for the local unit of the DNR and this local conservation organization, as I mentioned. Your point is well taken. It's a large amount of money for a small piece of land. And so as we continue to prioritize which parcels we will work on, you know, that is one of those factors. Are we being efficient with our funds that are granted to us? And so we are not for certain that would move forward. There's a lot more exploration that would need to occur. Your point is well taken. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you all. We're going to move on to the next proposal. And unless Amanda tells me that I'm wrong, we're going to go to HAO2 Metro Big Rivers. This is Deb Loon. Great, Deb, if you want to unmute yourself, and go ahead. Deb, you need there.
Okay. Sorry, I thought you were still on the other proposal.
No, we moved on.
All right.
You.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the LSOHC. Happy to be here this morning. My name is Deb Loon. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Valley Trust, which is a nonprofit that works to expand and improve habitat and public access to the Minnesota Valley National Wildlife Refuge. I am also the lead for the Metro Big Rivers Partnership. This is phase 11 of the Metro Big Rivers Habitat Program, which is HAO2 in your records. We are your trusted partner for habitat protection, restoration, and enhancement work in the metro urbanizing area. Metro Big Rivers is a partnership of five experienced, respected conservation organizations with long track records of habitat protection, enhancement, and restoration. With me on the call and available to answer questions are my partners from the Friends of the Mississippi River, Great River Greening, the Minnesota Land Trust, and the Trust for Public Land. The vision of Metro Big Rivers is to build a cohesive network of significant habitat for wildlife with an emphasis on the corridors and tributaries of the three big rivers in the metro area to benefit migrating and resident waterfowl, birds, and wildlife, and the 3 million residents who live in the urban, suburban, and rural parts of the metro area. Metro Big Rivers partners work from their strengths and within their networks and geographies. We build on each other's work, and we work very closely with local, state, and federal partners to achieve our shared conservation and public access objectives. Metro Big Rivers regularly meets and exceeds expectations. To date, we've completed work on 6,500 acres in the metro area, and we are working on another 2,200 acres right now, for a total of 8,700 acres to date. We regularly exceed our planned objectives by at least 110%. To continue our work in the metro urbanizing area, which is one of your LSOHC priorities, we encourage you to fund phase 11. By next July, we will have essentially completed phases 1 through 8, which is through ML 2018, and be well into phases 9 and 10. As of today, Metro Big Rivers has spent and obligated $21.6 million of LSOHC funds, and we have aggressively leveraged those funds. We have brought in $10.6 million of other funds to date for our projects. That has extended the impact of OHF grant funds by 59%, and more is on the way, of course. For phase 11, we will have significant impact over 2,322 acres if fully funded. We will continue to expand and improve wildlife habitat in the metro area, protecting a total of 1,763 acres, 835 by fee title and 928 by conservation easement. We will restore 106 acres and we will enhance 453 acres of significant but degraded habitat at 13 public sites and on some eased lands. Our handout provided to you includes the summary information I just provided. It also includes some descriptions of selected projects that exemplify our work completed. As you know, the Twin Cities Metro is on the migratory flyway. We need to protect critical habitat and restore degraded habitat within that flyway. The metro area has significant habitat that should be protected from development and improved to the benefit of wildlife and residents. To build a conservation ethic for the future, we need to introduce new and younger residents to outdoor wildlife-based recreation. We can do that by making sure everyone has high-quality natural habitat and opportunities nearby, including within the state's largest population center. In summary, the Metro Big Rivers partnership brings experience. We get the job done in the metro area. We have opportunity in the metro. There is significant habitat worth investing in through protection, restoration, and enhancement. And we leverage OHF funds. We've spent an obligated $21.6 million, and we've leveraged those funds with another $10.6 million. So we thank you very much for your support and your confidence in our work and the opportunity to be here. We'd be happy to answer questions.
Great, thank you. Are there questions? Well, you brought everyone along and no one has any questions.
So. Oh, come on.
You must have done a really good job. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Mark, yeah.
I have a technical question, and maybe, I don't know, maybe more for Mark. I was looking on page 2 and they highlighted a number of different small enhancements and restoration projects. Would any of these or do these qualify for the small grants program?
I can take a shot at that and then invite my FMR and Great River Greening to chime in. Some of the projects, we all do some projects that access CPL grants. But these are, we obviously can't fund all of our projects through CPL grants. So I know that FMR and GRG, I go after CPL grants to do some restoration work on some of the land that we acquire. So there, we are all doing a lot of work using both the OHF grant and CPL grants.
Okay, other questions? All right, now you're released. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think we have Brent Rudolph with the Minnesota Habitat Collaborative, Northeast Minnesota Forest Habitat Enhancement.
Yes,
project, FREO3. All right, Brent, unmute yourself and go ahead.
All right. Thanks very much, everyone. I appreciate your time and the remarkable flexibility everybody's showing working in very new and different ways these days. I myself have been struggling with some internet connectivity issues this morning and a laptop that's also had some independent issues with itself, but I think we're squared away and ready to go now. I wanted to point out that I'll be taking the bulk of the duties to provide the brief address with everyone here this morning. I should be joined, hopefully I'm being joined right now, by Dan Ryan, wildlife biologist with the Superior National Forest, and with Chris Dunham, the Resilience Forestry Manager with the Nature Conservancy. These gentlemen are two others of the number of different organizations and agencies that are part of the Moose Collaborative and have a longer personal history with the project that can help address particularly any questions you may have. With that, I will jump right in. I think everybody here is well aware moose have a truly iconic status in Minnesota, potentially the iconic wildlife species, and that's coming from someone with a strong personal affiliation with ruffed grouse myself. But as a as an iconic species in the state, they have also experienced some challenges in population trends since the early 2000s. The DNR winter aerial surveys have estimated that population across the moose range in the northeast portion of the state where our project is focused declined from a high of about 8,000, a little over 8,000 moose in 2005. To a low of about 2,760 estimated moose in 2013. 2013 was the year that the Moose Habitat Collaborative initially kicked off its efforts from a variety of interests in being able to intervene and see some additional improvements in moose habitat to help attempt to address this decline. Since that time, the population has been relatively stable at between 3,000 to 4,000, and the 2020 estimate was right in that range, about 3,150. With that in mind, then, the area of the collaborative has covered Cook, Lake, and St. Louis counties. So those are all three of the counties encompassing the core of the Moose Range, as identified in the Moose Management Plan that was adopted in 2011. And again, with numerous partners, including NGOs, the Rough Grouse Society, the Nature Conservancy, and the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, a number of public land administrative agencies, including the Superior National Forest, the Divisions of Forestry and Division of Fish and Wildlife with Minnesota DNR, and then the county, St. Louis County, counties as other land administrators in the region. The tribal authorities include 1854 Treaty Authority and the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa that have provided research and technical advice and monitoring efforts throughout the history of the collaborative. And the University of Minnesota Duluth Natural Resources Research Institute has also played a research and monitoring role throughout the time. Now in operating since 2013, this phase four proposal would seek to continue the landscape and site level documentation and vetting process that the collaborative has used to enhance between 17 and 19,000 acres now in the prior phases. And we've identified additional 20,000 acres to work with partners on. So Rough Grouse Society is taking a new role as the administrator and fiscal agent on the project. We have been a collaborator in the past. Some may obviously recognize with grouse in our name, what's the involvement in the Moose Collaborative Project? But there's a couple of important things to keep in mind. First of all, Rough Grouse Society, with nearly a 60-year history of conservation work is a proponent of science-based forest and wildlife management. Our mission overall is very simply to unite conservationists to improve wildlife habitat and forest health. So there are a variety of management guidance and coordination efforts under the project that we support wholeheartedly regardless. And then certainly rough grouse are one of the other additional indicator species identified in the collaborative as very likely to benefit from a vast majority of the work that would be conducted. There are numerous other species of greatest conservation need that would also benefit as identified in the application. The overall effort then is to look at, there's a variety of purposes that commercial timber harvest in the area can serve to provide effective tool to enhance wildlife habitat in the Moose Range, but the application has had a strong history of being able to support non-commercial treatments that will be essential for continuing to improve moose habitat and to coordinate across land ownership. So identifying where the best opportunities for benefiting moose within the broad range can be targeted both from a landscape perspective and then from a very specific site selection process. So we've had a history with the collaborative partners involved in identifying the best opportunities to emphasize management under the grant program and then also to coordinate with commercial forest operations that are happening independently of the collaborative and the grant to continue to have a broader impact to benefit moose across areas where there are the best opportunities to do so. I think with that, you have seen a variety of other materials we've provided. We made sure that some supplemental materials were included with letters of support from several of the partner agencies, identifying their enthusiastic continued participation with our new role here, addressing some of the aspects about coordination across entities and finding the best opportunities for implementing site work under the grant. And then a recent article from Minnesota Outdoor News that highlighted the kind of ongoing success of the program and some of the administrative changes that are occurring now. And with that, I can make sure if Dan and Chris are on and have anything else to add briefly. They could do so. Otherwise, we can kick over to questions.
You're kind of out of time for a presentation. I'm going to move us straight to questions.
Certainly.
Are there questions? Ron?
Yeah, I have to mention this. That among the other critters that your habitat project would help, you did not mention white-tailed deer, even though it seems to me the kind of habitat you're working on would indeed help white-tailed deer, which brings up the conundrum because deer carry the brainworm disease that is a major limitation on moose populations. How do you balance that?
Yeah, thank you. Excellent question. I think the primary way that is balanced, and that is a very valid point, certainly much of the early successional habitat created through the proposal is habitat that would be utilized by deer as well. It's balanced by the state management guidelines that have increased kind of the effort to reduce deer populations through harvest, hunting and harvest regulations in the range. Improvement of habitat for a variety of wildlife will certainly benefit deer as well. The state has developed their guidelines to try and keep deer populations at a lower level than the habitat would be able to support in order to offset that impact from the potential effects of brainworm on moose.
David, I think we should also point out that one reason the Minnesota deer hunters are not involved with you now is because they objected to DNR's effort to basically cut the deer population down there to like four deer per square mile or whatever it was in the name of helping moose. I get that. But so they had quite a controversy there. And that's why the Rough Grouse Society is now in the hot seat there.
Yeah, Minnesota Deer Hunters Association has been pretty straightforward with us that they have been very supportive and will continue to be a partner on the collaborative, but because of differences of opinion on deer management policy from their membership base, felt they couldn't continue to be in the lead coordinating role here. So they've set us up in a good situation to have access to their folks and the resources they've used as the coordinator in the past, and we've had very constructive conversations with them and the rest of the partners about stepping into this new role. But yeah, they're stepping into the background largely because of disagreements over those policy, deer management policy positions.
Other questions? All right, thank you, gentlemen. We're gonna move on to HA03, Lower Otter Tail River Corridor Habitat Restoration. I think we're waiting for Kathy Finger.
Actually, this is Eric Jones. I'm going to be Kathy today, so.
All right. Well, I don't know what Kathy looks like, so maybe I wouldn't have known the difference. But go ahead, please.
Thank you, Chairman Hartwell and members, for the opportunity to present at this hearing. My name's Eric Jones. And for the past 22 years, I've served as the district engineer for the Buffalo Red River Watershed District. The Watershed District, officed in Barnesville, Minnesota, has been developing an important project on the lower reach of the Otter Tail River that I'd like to share with you today. The Watershed District was started in 1960 to deal with water problems. We continue to make progress on dealing with water issues through the implementation of projects. If you recall, a few years ago, we presented to many of you our Wolverton Creek Restoration Project, which you graciously funded. I'm happy to say that phase one of that project was completed this summer, and phase two project construction will begin later this month. When completed in 2021, over 20 miles of stream restoration will be completed. You also provided funding for a stream habitat restoration program. I'm pleased to say that permitting and plans are in place for the first phase, and construction of approximately 5 miles of restoration of the South Branch of the Buffalo River is expected to be completed in 2021. The project we have before you today begins to address some of the historic problems and loss of habitat within the Otter Tail River portion of the Watershed District. We believe we have the ability, technical expertise, and willing landowners to restore the river and its habitat. Much of the Otter Tail River habitat degradation was the result of a flood control project completed by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in the 1950s. The Corps straightened, deepened, and widened 18 miles of river into 11 miles of river, and the channelization of the river resulted in severe down-cutting and severe erosion of the channel. The straightened river currently provides little functional aquatic or riparian corridor habitat, and has reduced connectivity to portions of the river upstream and downstream of the straightened reach. This is the Watershed District's first request for funding for permanent conservation easement acquisition for their Lower Otter Tail River Corridor Habitat Restoration Project. The project involves four phases. Phase one involves land acquisition and upland restoration. Phase two involves detailed river restoration design and setback levee construction. Phase three is the actual river restoration. And phase four, the final phase, is ongoing maintenance of the constructed project features and easement areas. The Watershed District began development of this project in 2015 by initiating conversations with the Wilkin County and its Soil and Water Conservation District and the Minnesota DNR. And in 2016, the Watershed District received Section 319 funding through the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and a Clean Water Fund grant through the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources. These grant funds were allowed for survey work and development of a detailed concept plan for river restoration. Concurrent with those efforts, the Watershed District began discussions with the Corps of Engineers. This led to a partnering with the Corps on a Section 1135 ecosystem restoration feasibility evaluation and further refinement of the river restoration setback levy alignment proposed in future phases of the project. The feasibility study is expected to be completed in early 2021. The preliminary project evaluation suggests that the Corps will take a federal interest in the restoration of the river. And what that means is potentially the Corps can bring $10 million to restore portions of the Otter Tail River affected by their 1950s straightening work. However, the Section 1135 program leaves the responsibility for land rights to project proposers, which is the reason for this application. The Watershed District, Wilkin SWCD, and the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources are partnering to use the Reinvest in Minnesota, the RIM program, to secure, maintain, and monitor easements within the corridor. Since this is a large project, the river restoration reach has been divided into reaches A, B, and C. The location of these reaches were shown on the proposal illustration. This funding request will target acquisition in reach A of the corridor. And while the land acquisition will be prioritized to reach A, other opportunities to protect lands within or adjacent to the main corridor will also be considered. A total of 850 acres of land is targeted for this first request for acquisition. This project is a land acquisition phase of a long-term project that will ultimately restore the 11 current miles of river to about 18 miles of restored river and over 3,300 acres of habitat for associated fish and wildlife communities. Once acquisition is complete, future channel restoration phases of the project will be completed with the assistance of the Minnesota DNR and the Army Corps. The Watershed District will be the local sponsor, responsible for final design and construction of the project. The Watershed District has developed marketing materials to utilize in soliciting applications when 2021 funds become available in July. The Watershed District takes a comprehensive approach to watershed management and expects benefits from this project that include natural resource enhancement, habitat improvements, flood damage reduction, and water quality benefits. At this time, we'd welcome any questions from the council.
Great, any questions? Mark?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know there's a lot of energy that's been spent down in that part of the state on flood hazard mitigation, flood damage reduction grants. And I understand you're presenting this as a restoration, but how will it affect flood mitigation?
Yeah, this project in particular is much more heavily weighted towards natural resource enhancement and habitat. The issue here is that the Otter Tail River, because of the straightening project that was done in the 50s, downcut significantly. And in order to reconnect some of the old meanders that still exist out there, we have to bring much of the channel bottom back up. By doing that, we actually reduce some of the capacity of the river. And so there was some discussion in the application that talked about setback levies. That's to limit impacts on the neighboring lands adjacent to where these easements would be put into place. From a flood damage reduction basis, you know, that we're not expecting any huge FDR flood damage reduction benefits from this project. It's more probably more benefits in regard to water quality. The downcutting that resulted from the straightening project results in about 30,000 tons per year of sediment being lost off the banks. Of course, that degrades the habitat as well. And because the river's been straightened, we have a very homogeneous reach. Those 11 miles don't have the historic deep pools in them. And those type of habitats that fish and aquatic species really rely on. So I don't know if that answers your question, Mark.
It does to some degree. And yes, it does. But I guess my next question is, so this is the start, not really the start, I mean, because you've done some engineering looks, or obviously.
Right.
walk me through the phases and the costs associated to phase two and three before the feds come in? What are we looking at for a future cost? If we start you down this road, what's the future bill coming to us for?
Right. I think overall cost is right around $35 million. That would be for land plus the restoration of the channel and habitat otherwise. But it's about 50-50 between the land acquisition costs and the restoration enhancement costs for the overall project. So as far as like timing wise, the Corps is going to work through their feasibility study. Their study is supposed to be done this coming spring. And at least all the preliminary stuff that we've seen to date has really shown that there's going to be a federal interest as far as bringing some funds to do restoration on the river itself. And that's part of the reason why the Watershed District engaged the Corps, was the idea that it was an opportunity to bring some federal funds into the restoration of the channel.
Okay. Let me ask you in a little different way.
Sure.
We fund you this phase and then we're done. Can this stand alone with what we've done?
Yeah, you won't have the river restoration portion of it completed, but all the uplands will be restored as part of this. So any land that would be acquired through this first request, all that land would be restored to native prairie mainly along the river. So there would be habitat benefits there right from the get-go. And then in my opinion, the big reward would be when the river actually gets restored down the road. And that'll be a few years down the road before that really would begin to happen.
So I see Denny has a question, but let me just follow up. Everything except the restoration cost, which the Army Corps would be in for $10 million if you had your wish, would be about $25 million for 3,300 acres. Is that correct?
Well, it's about $35 million for everything. That would include the river restoration in there too.
Yeah, but if you take $10 million out, which is what you said the Corps would put in for river restoration, you're talking $25 million.
Yeah,
or 3,300 acres of habitat, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Denny, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jones, I'm curious. So this is a easement acquisition. So at any point, will you actually fee title acquire land when you change the alignment of the river? Or is that actually done with an easement where you get the landowner to agree that the channel will change? And is that discussion and put in place when you acquire these preliminary or this first stage easements?
Yeah, that's a great question. So yes, those discussions would be in place with the landowner when they sign the easement. There's kind of two easements that would be taken here. You'd have the conservation rim easement, but then you'd also have a watershed district easement that would allow for that future modification of the channel.
Denny, do you have a follow-up? Or?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And then, Mr. Jones, we've had some of these similar projects when you actually go to move the channel, but I commend you for the idea that you're getting these easements ahead of time with discussion with the property owners about moving the channel. What about property owners? Do you anticipate property owners outside of the ones you're buying the easements from, their land to be affected by flooding less or more by your actions? I'm just thinking of some things we had happen up in the Rosso River area.
Yeah, we really, as a watershed district, we can't let that happen. what we'll be doing, if there are areas that have the potential to have more flooding. Those are areas that we would build small berms to basically limit where the water could go. And part of that is because we're bringing the water back, or bringing the channel bottom back up to what it would have been closer to historically. So we do have to try, you know, we have to put some, we call it just some mitigation measures in place. And all this stuff, you know, all the work that's been done to date, some of the modeling of the river, you know, this has all got established flood, FEMA floodplain, that type of thing. So there's a whole bunch of different constraints that we're trying to operate within. And clearly making flooding worse isn't one of the things that we can live with on this project.
So I'd like to just follow up on the gap of the $20 million and where you think that's going to come from. If the Army Corps had put in 10 and you're asking us for 4,500 and you need another 20 million, where are you anticipating that money coming from?
Well, I mean, this is request number one. Clearly we would come back to you guys for potential additional funding. The watershed district itself does have taxing authority, so there would be some local assessment for a project like this. It may be over the entire watershed district. The watershed does a annual assessment over the watershed district that helps to pay for projects like this. And then, you know, the watershed district has a long history of knocking on lots of different doors, you know, 319, clean water funds, things like that. We don't leave too many stones unturned.
All right, other questions? For discussion, I'm sensing we might not take a full hour. Would you rather continue on with proposals and try to get this done in 3 days instead of four? What's your pleasure? Denny says yes. Yes, no. 3 days from Tom. Mark?
I'm happy to keep going and work on this. I guess I'm a little interested in having a conversation at the end of this. And would we get a quality conversation at the end of this tomorrow, or would it be better to push that into Thursday morning?
I think it'll depend a little bit on how the day ends. I would anticipate we'd have a little conversation at the end of the day if we keep going, and then have time for a good conversation either tomorrow after the presentations or on Thursday morning, but we need to have a conversation.
Yeah, I would say push hard through today. And
okay.
We could through today and then to lighten up the load tomorrow.
All right.
So we have more time to talk.
Anyone have any difficulty with that? Seeing none, we'll move on to HA05, Mississippi Headwaters Habitat Corridor. Tim Terrell. Tim, unmute yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the council. I'm Tim Terrell, Executive Director of the Mississippi Headwaters Board. I'm here today with Will Cooksey, the Senior Program Manager for the Trust for Public Land, Paula West, the Project Coordinator for this program, and Bill Penny, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, Northern Forest Rim Program Manager. I want to thank you all for taking the time to hear us today. With this proposal, we accomplish 8 miles of critical shoreline, as well as get 2,875 acres of high quality wildlife habitat to protect the Mississippi River, headwaters, lakes, reservoirs, and major tributaries. Our goal is to create and expand contiguous protected habitat complexes, as well as reduce forest fragmentation, which is one of our biggest issues up here. To date, with all the
funding that has been received, we've been able to protect 3,441 acres and 31 miles of shoreline. And that exceeded our projected goals by 200%. We also have some projects in process, and they are, that would, if you total what we've done to date along with what's in the hopper, we're looking at 4,667 acres and 42 miles of shoreline protected. We also had clean water funds given to us just this year, and that is $500,000, and we committed those to two projects with that will add an additional 800 acres, 4 miles of shoreline. So as we move on and we do things, we've been able to close out ML-16 prior to us, ML-17 and 18, 95 of that is already spent, and the remainder obligated the projects. And with the funding you just gave us on July 1st, 2020, we already have 30% of it already committed because we have a waiting list for easement. So we're really getting and accomplishing. We have a lot of landowners that are interested in what we're doing. I also think it's also because we have great partners that have doing good work up here and see the benefit. And also, I think one of the key drivers is when we first applied for funding, we had the Mississippi Headwaters Board of Counties write resolutions of support for this type of program. And that leadership really drove this program to move forward. And I'm very happy with our commissioners and everybody who's on board from a very high level to a very implementation level as well. With that, I will let Will Cooksey from the Test for Public Land talk over what has his perception on this.
Good morning, Chairman Hartwell and members. Will Cooksey, Senior Project Manager with the Trust for Public Land. As follow-up to Tim's overview, I wanted to dig into this partnership's accomplishments to date and bring to light the nearly 3,500 acres that the partnership has permanently protected to date permanently protecting roughly 31 miles of shoreline. So if I could direct your attention to the second page of the handout, which illustrates a few examples, our goal to create and expand protected habitat complexes and keep this beautiful geography forested. So scrolling down, the second example is in Aiken County, where we've leveraged the protections afforded by the Savannah State Forest by completing six projects to date. That's five easements along the river and one fee acquisition, which was an addition to the Savannah State Forest, and is open to the public for recreation, for hunting and fishing. Those projects and cumulative protected 8 miles of shoreline and blocked up some key parcels there along the river. A second example that I just want to highlight here is the Indian Jack Wildlife Management Area complex. Indian Jack Lake WMA is a new wildlife management area that this partnership created just recently in a part of Crow Wing County that is experiencing increased conversion and other development pressure. And we're really pleased to be able to protect that gem of the lake and including some shoreline along the river. Additionally, we've supplemented that WMA with an easement to the east. We're working on another easement on the other side of the river with a lot of shoreline, and we have a roughly 40-acre parcel under contract right now that we're looking to add to the WMA complex to make that to make that unit more robust, have more shoreline, and provide more habitat value. So with that, I'll open it up to questions.
Great questions. Looks like you adequately described the project, Will. Thank you very much.
Thank you, members.
All right. Next, we will go to HA07, Riparian Habitat Protection for the Kettle and Snake River Watersheds with Jill Carlier.
Good morning. My name is Jill Carlier, and I'm the manager at Pine Soil and Water Conservation District. I would like to thank all the members for hearing our presentation today. Our project will utilize Bowser Rim conservation easements in the Kettle River and Snake River watersheds to protect approximately 1,300 acres of high-quality private forests, wetlands, and shoreline in the Northern Forest Ecological Section. Sites will be selected utilizing minor watershed RAC scoring and integrative ranking process developed through a collaborative process, which Jake will discuss in more detail later. Development in this area tends to pose a serious threat to lake sturgeon, four-toed and spotted salamanders, gilt darter, northern long-eared back, bats, banding turtles, and over 128 unique, rare, endangered, and threatened species that live in the watersheds. Watersheds in northern Minnesota benefit from public lands since they are mostly forested. The primary risk to habitat and water quality is on private lands. Private forest lands are key because they are more likely to be developed, resulting in habitat fragmentation, increased pollution and stormwater runoff, siltation and sedimentation of water bodies. Conversion of private forest lands to more intense land uses place negative impacts on both wildlife habitat and water quality. Both the Kettle and Snake River watersheds have experienced an increase in development and land use conversion in recent years. Because of its proximity to the Twin Cities, this area is under increasing pressure from human activities, including the expansion of residential development, some of it affecting river shoreline. Healthy forests, wetlands, and shorelines in watersheds are vital to the water quality. If we do nothing, this type of development along rivers will continue. Increases in housing density and associated development on rural forest lands can be linked to numerous changes to private forest services across watersheds, including decreases in native wildlife, changes in forest health, and reduced water quality, forest carbon storage, timber production, and recreational benefits. Protecting healthy watersheds with conservation easements now is a cost-effective strategy to ensure that the ecosystem and the economic services provided by a healthy watershed remain intact. Jake?
Sure. So my name is Jake Carlo, Mr. Chairman and council members. As Jill said, my name is Jake Granforce, Pheasants River Farm Bill wildlife biologist covering Aiken and Carlton counties. In my daily duties, I work with private landowners planning habitat projects, helping them meet their management objectives. And as biologists, we have many tools available to assist landowners in meeting their objectives. But one of the areas where we're lacking, especially in this work area, is permanent protection options, which is why I'm really excited for this opportunity. So to give you a little background on how the minor watershed RAC scoring methodology was developed and how we plan to target lands for easements, I'll explain that here. So in 2016, Minnesota DNR, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, working with the Soil and Water Conservation Districts and partners, developed a protection framework based on research done by DNR Fisheries. The Minnesota DNR identified a strong correlation between water quality and habitat that sustains fish populations and maintaining 75% forest land cover in a watershed. So our process works as follows. First, we will prioritize minor watersheds that have less than 75% protection. We will then target specific parcels using RAC scores to maximize the conservation benefit per dollar or return on investment. So the RAC scoring stands for riparian, adjacent, and quality, where each parcel, forest or parcel, is scored on a 0 to 10 scale, where proximity to water is a riparian, adjacent to or protected lands is adjacency, and then various locally defined features such as old growth forests, rare species, biodiversity, wild rice, and trout and cisco. So that's the quality. So RAC, riparian adjacent quality. And in addition to that RAC methodology, the scoring, we also use a local technical committee of the all the soil and water districts and partners working on it, in addition to other partners, DNR, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, to look at each easement. And we use a score sheet that looks at feet of shoreline protected, the development potential of each site, the depth from the shoreline the easement will cover, watershed considerations. And so each easement that the county SWCs bring is brought to this local technical committee to be approved for funding. And each of these parcels that are brought go through this vetting process. And usually the parcels that rank the highest are the ones adjacent to public land or in a river corridor or both. So, which makes sense being that we're using riparian and adjacency as key factors. So just in short, this two-step methodology using the RAC tool and the local technical committee, we are prioritizing parcels with benefits overlapping, habitat, biodiversity, cost, water quality, and resilience to create and protect habitat complexes. Therefore, using this minor watershed methodology, we're stacking the public benefits to maximize conservation benefits per dollar. And over time, we will measure the progress towards that 75% protection forest land goal on a watershed basis. Thank you for your time and opportunity to protect these watersheds. We will stand for questions.
Great, are there questions? Ron, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just noticing there's no leverage for this project. I'm trying to understand why you didn't reach out to the people of Pine County or others to add to this. It's almost like, I won't say what it seems like, but did you try to get some leverage here or no?
Mr. Chair, maybe I could take a shot at that. This is a brand new project for us, and we have not worked in this area very much in the past, the RIM program, that is. And we're working on building up those partnerships right now, but we did not have any available sources of additional funding at this point in time.
Other questions? Good enough. Thank you very much. We will move on to HA04, Fisheries Habitat Protection on Strategic North Central Minnesota Lakes. Kathy Don Carlos.
Mr. Chair and members, we don't have HA04. They're one of the groups that, the group that's shifted after the break is the group that could go earlier on Wednesday, but was unable to go today.
So do we have anyone left who's capable?
We don't. Yeah, we do have some people kind of hanging out in the waiting room still from prior presentations, but okay. Don't have anybody else, unfortunately.
Well, then we won't move on. We should tomorrow be able to get through the remaining proposals and still have time for discussion based on what we were capable of doing today, which would mean tentatively releasing you on Thursday. But don't give up the time yet until we're sure we can do that.
But I'd love to open it up to questions or comments or discussion among members about what we heard today and any thoughts. No thoughts? Good. Tom. You're on mute, Tom. There you go.
Right now?
Yep, you're good now.
Well, going backwards from this last presentation, I was happy to see that it seems that more and more, generally more and more of the projects are dealing with watersheds, and you know, that's just something that we've got to be dealing with along too. If we're talking about rivers, that's fine, and the shoreline's great, but it's pretty obvious that what can really harm our rivers and our river systems are the huge watersheds that particularly the larger rivers have. That's my comment.
Great. Denny? Denny, are you frozen up on us? I don't think Denny's with us anymore, unfortunately. Other comments? Well, given that there are no comments, I guess we will adjourn for the day and be back at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning and see if we can get through this and then have a discussion overall about what we've seen tomorrow. But don't release your Thursday morning yet because there are no guarantees. And we do want to have time for a discussion. So with that, thank you all very much. And we will be adjourned for the day and see you tomorrow.
Thank you.
Thanks.